Welcome, everyone, to our first interim meeting of the Senate Business Transportation and Economic Development Committee. We're one member short, so we're going to move ahead with the information items. And the first one up is update on the rest stop and travel information activities. Patrick, do you have anything before we invite the guest up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can briefly mention that the folks from the Travel Information Council will be presenting, brought some informational materials for you there in front of you underneath your agenda. Mr. Chair.
Please. We have Abe Lincoln and
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here with the Travel Information Council, and I have with me one of our council members, Rod Miles, who will be giving you a brief presentation after I'm done with my comments. And the beard is to make sure that you know that I'm conveying honest and forthright information.
Oh, good.
For a little bit of background, the Travel Information Council was originally created in 1972. And up until recently was predominantly responsible for the travel information signs that you see along the highways. They're the blue signs that give you notification of gas, food, and lodging as you approach an exit. They also have the responsibility for Oregon's Heritage Tree Program, where there are certain trees that have been set aside because of their history, longevity, and their significance culturally to the area, and historical markers along Oregon's highway right-of-way that identify historical elements for the state of Oregon. After January 1st of 2010, as a result of the Jobs and Transportation Act, which I'm sure most, if not all of you, are very familiar with here at the dais, you gave the Travel Information Council the opportunity to start a pilot project whereby they took on the management, maintenance, and upgrading of 10 rest areas, north and south of five different locations, those being the Manzanita rest stop, the Santa Ana rest stop, Baldock, Boardman, and Umatilla. Along with that goal, our job was to try, as I said, to manage, maintain, and upgrade those rest areas. And the way we went about that is, in order to manage and maintain them, we ended up hiring local businesses to help us do landscaping, plumbing, and that sort of thing. In addition, we hired on-site managers for each of those five areas. Of the 10 that we hired, six of them were either unemployed or underemployed, and now are working for Travel Information Council, serving the traveling public as they come into those rest areas. Part of what we tried to do is we were trying to create a kind of a new direction that was prompted largely by some desire on the part of legislators, but also as we went along by local government officials and local businesses to try and convey an economic development message through rest areas that would divert traffic into nearby areas so that they might go to a nearby hotel or restaurant or visit a nearby winery or visit the nearby festival that was going on along those lines. So in order to facilitate that, we started a model of creating coalitions of local government and local business folks. The first one we did that with was with the Baldock, which is by far the largest and most active of the rest areas that we took on. What we found quickly is that they had a lot of vision for what they wanted to do with the Baldock, but the Baldock had a problem in that they had 30 to 40 permanent residents, homeless population, which went up to 100 at times, including at one point in time they even had a bus coming through and picking up kids for school, although that had disappeared by the time we came in. So the Travel Information Council, working with our partners with ODOT State Police, the District Attorney's Office at the Baldock, legal aid, and the local human services folks, were able to work through a process where we adopted rules for conduct in the rest area. We enforced those rules so that those that were homeless knew that we were serious about that, but then instead of just having them move on, we got them connected up with the local district attorney and human services so that we got them into job training, we got them into housing, and in fact, three of the people who were homeless have now been hired to help maintain the Baldock rest area. That model that we've developed around our rest areas that are coalition-oriented groups are predominantly trying to figure out how they can use those rest areas, as I said, to get economic development messaging so that when people are coming down the freeway, they're more likely to stop off of that local area. It's become a national model that others have taken on. Some coalitions have developed on their own around some rest areas in the state of Oregon. As a matter of fact, there's one that around government camp in Mount Hood, which is scheduled for closing, but there's been a coalition that's developed on its own around that in the hopes of trying to keep that open. So it really enabled us to get people to want to invest in the rest areas, because as the Travel Information Council, we're funded through highway funds, which limits what we can do in those rest areas. But by harnessing the local economic development folks, the local business folks, and local governments, we make them partners in doing things that could perhaps enhance our visitor centers that are in those rest areas and things like that. So we've done a lot of thinking outside the box, and we're trying to really meet the needs that the legislature set for us. The easiest one, of course, was making sure that when you stop out at a rest stop, you have a clean, safe place to go to the restroom, stop for a little while, perhaps have a picnic or things like that. But our desire is to meet the needs of the coalitions that we put together to go one step further and make us a value to them as local communities. I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Rod Miles, who has a presentation for you about some of the next direction we're going to be going in as a Travel Information Council. And I don't always get to say this about clients, but the Travel Information Council is a group of individuals that have a relatively rare can-do attitude, and they're constantly trying to think outside the box about how they can better serve the people that you've directed us to serve. So with that, I'll turn you over to Rod.
Before you do, I'm curious, you mentioned safety, cleanliness, and how are you doing with that at that rest stop? And do you have a resident manager or a resident keeper? What do you call it, groundskeeper there?
Mr. Chair, we don't have a resident keeper, but we do have two full-time staff that are associated with them. So they're not there 24 hours a day. But through their presence, arrangements we've made with both the county sheriff's office and state police for doing patrols in that area, and working with the homeless population, we've been able to reduce crime substantially. And we don't have homeless folks that are living in the rest stop anymore. A lot of that is also because ODOT worked with us to develop rules that would allow us to enforce standards in those rest areas, so everyone really knows what the rules are. Before that, it was much more difficult.
How about cleanliness of the restrooms?
Mr. Chair, that we're doing very well with as well, mostly because we have people who are there and know that that's critically important to what our mission is. The best way to find out is for you to go and visit the ball dock to see for yourself. And, of course, I would encourage anyone to do that.
And that is, to be clear, that's the one that's just south of Wilsonville?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Mr. Chair. Question.
Senator Starr?
the question I have is how are we supposed to take your testimony in the future, in the event that you shave the beard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'm sure that there will be some other way that I can convey to you just how honest and forthright I am without the need of relying on cheap parlor tricks like growing hair around my face.
All right, let's check.
Good answer. Mr. Miles.
Mr. Chair and fellow members, my name is Rod Miles for the record, and I'm a counselor with the Oregon Travel Information Council. I thought what I'd share with you today is a process that we're going through as we have changed our responsibilities with TIC. And I believe you have a copy of this as well, but we'll have it up. We started when we took on the rest areas, really wanted to get a better handle on what people thought of TIC and what they didn't think about TIC. So we conducted some interviews, basically from the inside out. We started with the employees, every employee of TIC. We then talked to each one of the counselors on their own. We had an online survey with 200 of our current sign customers, the blue signs that are on the highways, and we also conducted a market survey of 200 different Oregon motorists, both on I-84 and on Interstate 5. What we kind of drilled down to is, what is this organization's DNA? And I'll go through this quickly for you, but we were trying to figure out what we call the five P's, or the purpose and the promise, what our position might be, what is our performance, and what is our personality. In terms of purpose, after we brought all this research together, it became very clear that we serve the business community by enhancing their brands of organizations, basically all those that buy our signs. We're a reflection of the local communities in which we exist, with those coalitions that we mentioned, and we are a high-profile representative of the larger community of Oregon. So the brand purpose boils down to we're the frontline experience for this motoring public. In terms of the promise, we discovered that we certainly provide accurate, helpful information that people can trust well, part of the motoring public, that we have a unique entrepreneurial spirit with the sale of these blue signs inside a publicly responsible organization, and we get people where they want to go. That is our brand promise. Third, we were talking in terms of the brand position. Our signs all carry a really unique, timely, incredible endorsement for the motorists. Our facilities are always safe, clean, convenient, and accessible. And we go the extra mile so that they don't have to. In terms of performance, we always want to ask ourselves, are we doing today, and are we anticipating exactly what our clients' needs might be? And what do we do today to better understand our clients' needs, whether it's the motorists, whether it's the sign customers, elected officials? So we call it our most positive guidance, and that's what we're working towards each and every day. In terms of personality, we are certainly customer-focused. That became very clear when we were talking to these 200 different clients that we have. We're a collaborative organization. We are innovative as a council, and we're resourceful. Last line is, we are your Oregon guides, and that's where we find ourselves with this motoring public. Going forward with our changes and with our responsibility changes, we also talk to these people about a different name, a different working name that we can go forward and have it make more sense than simply council. So the organization has decided in going forward with the name Oregon Travel Experience as a DBA. We want to keep it tied to the motoring public. We do that with this particular logo and the motoring sign and keep it in a positive way. So going forward, that's who we'll be. Thank you.
Rod, I guess one concern that I will express as you use the term client a lot, and I think you were referring to stakeholders, sign customers, and that. And I guess I kind of hear you talk a little bit about my perception is who you're really there to serve and through is the people traveling on the interstate and on the highways. And through doing that and doing it well, you'll serve the others. But is there any concern about getting a little bit of mixed focus by throwing that term client to represent a broader group?
Mr. Chair, this is used in-house. You bring up a good point. We don't think of our travelers as clients as much as we were addressing the 200 people that we surveyed who were existing clients with those signs.
Okay. Questions? I would just say, from my perspective, I will measure your success and how well those rest stops operate and how happy the customers who travel through Oregon, and we hope to leave money here.
And Mr. Chair, one thing I'll add to that is for a lot of people traveling in Oregon, those rest stops are the first experience they have coming through Oregon, so they better be in good shape so that they reflect well on the rest of Oregon, and that's our goal, is to make sure that those rest areas that we manage are that way.
Good. Well, if there are no other questions, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next up, now that we have a full committee, we have a bit of a business to do. We have to adopt rules. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rules that are provided before you are the standard boilerplate rules that Senate committees will be using this interim. For purposes of clarification, a quorum for this committee is 4. It's also the number required to suspend rules. Other than that, they're regular rules, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Patrick? Seeing none, Chair moves adoption of the rules as presented. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. All right. Next up is the implementation of House Bill 3247, the one-stop shop for Oregon business. Secretary Brown, Patrick, do you have any introductory comments?
No, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I believe the committee dealt with during the session, so you probably have more familiarity with it than I do, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to be here with you this afternoon. I'm Kate Brown, currently serving as Oregon's Secretary of State. I did want to congratulate Senator Edwards on his appointment to the Aspen Rodel Young Leaders Program. It was an incredible experience for me. I think Senator Girard would say I haven't learned much from my leadership experiences, but I hope that you take away a lot from that really incredible program. So congratulations. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about the implementation of House Bill 3247, which you all passed during the last legislative session, creating a one-stop-shop business portal. Folks have been talking about a one-stop-shop for quite a while. In fact, more than 30 years ago, Governor Attia envisioned a place where an Oregon business could get everything it needed at one place at the same time. And before I give you an update on House Bill 3247, I just wanted to talk briefly about our existing one-stop shop for businesses that my agency has been working on for a number of years in order to realize Governor Attia's vision. It's really easy to get the two of them confused. Our central business registry is the first place in Oregon that people go to get a business started. We want to make it as easy as possible to start a business in Oregon and create jobs. On our central business registry, you can go online, register your new business, and connect with other state agencies like Employment Department and the Department of Revenue, all in one site at the same time. During this biennium, we are going to be adding two additional services. The first one would allow you to connect with local governments as well as state agencies. So, for example, if I were starting a business in Lincoln City, I could get on the CBR, register with the Secretary of State, connect with the Department of Revenue for my payroll tax registration, and also in the future, get my business license through the city. In addition, once this phase is fully implemented, I'd be able to access state licensing agencies as well. So if I were starting a beauty salon, I could access the state cosmetology agency to acquire my salon license. Don't worry, Senator Atkinson, I'm not going into the hairdressing business anytime soon. Anyway, it's all one site and everything you need to get a business started in Oregon. So back to House Bill 3247, which in my mind is the one-stop-shop business portal and is really the icing on the cake. It will easily enable you to access the resources you need for business creation, retention, and expansion in Oregon. We have silos in state government for management purposes, but those silos make it difficult for people to access the programs that might provide a business owner with the assistance he or she needs. The purpose of the portal is to help the business owner navigate government and access the tools that he needs, whether they are already online, like our central business registry, or if it's a live human being that can answer questions and provide a service. It's really a virtual town hall, a town square, or a piazza, if you've ever seen one of those. So here's how I see it being used. I want to go ahead and get my hair salon started. I go to the portal and put in the areas that I need assistance on, and it would send me, for example, to the Business Oregon program that I need to get a small business loan, as well as pointing to me to licensing agencies, tax information, wage and hour laws, and so on. The purpose, from the public's perspective, is to eliminate the silos and confusion and direct folks to the resources they need easily and quickly from one website. With the one-stop business portal, the organization of government will no longer be a barrier to a business finding the information, services, and information they need to start, grow, and prosper. So thank you very much. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Peter Threlkell, my Director of Corporation Division.
Welcome.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office. It's my pleasure to provide a brief update on our plans and implementation of the one-stop business portal under House Bill 3247. Since the last session ended, we've tried to hit the ground running. The first order of business for us was to hire a project manager. We have done that. He is on board, and he's actively coordinating and leading our efforts to build out the business portal. So some of the activities that we've done to date, we've held numerous planning and contracting meetings with the Department of Administrative Services. We'll be meeting with the Department of Justice to finalize our contract, and we've had a number of meetings with the vendor that the e-government vendor for the state of Oregon, NICUSA. They're the company that has we're the 25th state to sign up with them. They're sort of the e-government people, and they're the ones that have built state portals in half the states, and when it comes time for states getting recognition and winning best of the award, almost every single time it's a state that's under contract with NIC. So we are very excited about the opportunity to work for them. They are very bright, some of the brightest people you'll ever talk to in the technology realm, we think that they're going to be able to do great things for us. So we've had the initial meetings with them. We're meeting with our partners and counterparts in the state's business agencies. We're going through identifying who the key players are there. We're looking forward to having meetings with, it's a group called the E-Governance Board, and this is made up of staff from the governor's agencies that their task and charge is the development and direction of the Oregon.gov portal. And so with the business portal, we'll actually be living inside there as part of that, as a sort of a sub-portal there. We think that it's very important for the state to have uniformity and consistency so that when somebody comes to the state's website, it doesn't feel like they've gone somewhere entirely different when they navigate off to another spot. So with that, we're going to be working with that e-governance board. They're very excited about working with us as the pilot project for the redevelopment of Oregon.gov as we're working with the new e-gov vendor. We are doing benchmarking, reviewing other state web portals, and looking for the best of breed out there. What are the types of services? What is the information that other states are making available to their business community to be successful? And to the extent that we can use great ideas, we want to implement that here in Oregon as well. As I mentioned, we're developing a statement of work and our contract, and that's ongoing effort right now. One of the things that I believe a couple of the members of this committee are involved with the Electronic Portal Advisory Board, and the contract with DAS and NIC is currently in the second phase. There's a third phase, which is implementation, and I believe there's a meeting coming up in October where the expectation or the hope is that the ePortal Advisory Board will approve DAS and NIC to move forward into the implementation phase. And this is really where we will then be able to finalize our contract and move our effort with the vendor into contracting, design, and building. Our goal is to have the business portal up by the end of June of 2012, and so we're kind of waiting for that next domino to fall, and then we'll be looking to begin building and constructing by the end of the year. So with that, that's my brief update. If you have to answer any questions that you have.
So how much of this already exists at the Biz Oregon website? Because they have a piece of that that's been there for a number of years that does that.
Chair Breyer, there's actually a lot of information at the Business Oregon website. We believe that we have good information and services and tools at our website. DCBS was recently recognized with their e-permitting application that also focuses out to the state and local governments, sort of a one-stop tool for the permitting process. So there's a lot of that information available. It's really trying to, you know, we won't be looking to move it into a central place, but this will be the point of navigation that you'll be able to get out to and find all those different resources. Right now, one of the things that, if you know how a program is organized in government and where it lives, you can find it. But that's sort of the challenge, and for a lot of people, that this might be their first interaction with government in starting their business, or this is the first time that they've hired employees, and just knowing, well, do I need to talk to OSHA? Do I need to talk to workers' comp or BOLI or Department of Revenue because I have to get set up for payroll taxes? And just really kind of sharing and making that information available, accessible in one place.
Not that easy to navigate Oregon.gov.
And that was a lot of the impetus that, you know, what we're trying to improve upon and make it so that at least for the business community, that they can get to where they want to go. I know the some of the folks that we've talked to on the e-governance board, they're excited about the potential that this is really a pilot that helps them. You know, maybe the state wants to develop a transportation portal or an education portal and really allow... Take that information, you know, somebody's come to your website, they've told you that they're interested in something, you know, let's immerse them in that world and make the experience richer and deeper for them so that they really start to get all the access to the relevant information that they're after, get it quickly, get it timely, get them to the right place without having to wade through and sort through all the thousands of different results that, you know, really don't pertain to what they're after. So that's a lot of what we're trying to accomplish.
Have you already got a schematic of the services that you want to have provided through that?
We have some ideas. That's a part of what we'll be developing with the other agencies over the next coming months. We're, there's a lot of information out there. We're probably going to have to try to avoid just a huge list of links. Some of the other states have done some really forward-thinking, outstanding work in utilizing search technology. You know, Google as a company is very successful because of the way they manage and handle search. And we've seen, as we're looking at the state of Utah, the state of Arkansas, that handle search really well. I especially like the one that if you go to Arkansas.gov and you were to do a search, it starts to build out results dynamically on the fly. It gives you sort of three different columns of information, you know, so here are resources, here are services, here are people that you can go and contact. Utah is very similar. They provide forms. Forms are very popular content for people coming to government websites. So, you know, we want to look at how we can utilize some of that and really just be able to interact with the public and the business community and just get them right to what they're looking for and make it easy for them.
I assume the primary target of this is small businesses, particularly business startups. Or how are you involving people who might go through this or have gone in design?
So one of the plans that we have, we have a great focus on trying to make sure that there's high usability, and we want to engage, whether it's focus groups or individuals on a very early basis as we're starting to develop this out, and we want to make sure that their feedback and their input is brought in so that, that we can take advantage of that and build something that's really going to work for them.
Okay. Other questions?
Chair.
Senator.
Well, first of all, Secretary Brown, I would like to correct the record. It was actually Robert Straub who was talking about one-stop permitting before ATIA was. But your point is taken. It's been talked about for a very, very long time. My question is, where do people find out how to get to the portal? I mean, once they get to the portal, it looks like you've got a system for them to be able to navigate it. But how do they find out that it even exists?
Chair Beyer, Senator Burdick. One of the things that I think NICUSA brings to the table and what they've done in other states is the ability to help government with some of its marketing outreach, making sure that when somebody puts in a search on a Google or another search engine, that we are highly optimized so that our results come back at the very top. If somebody has to flip through 3 or 4 pages to get through our information, they're never going to find us. People go on the web and they might give you about 10 seconds of their time and then they're off to something else. So that will be a component as we're working with them and trying to utilize their resources to help with that kind of marketing and outreach. One of the primary things, and we, when the bill first came up, we immediately started talking to the state CIO, the e-government program, engaged NIC, NICUSA, as well, because we wanted to make sure that as the efforts are going forward on the Oregon.gov portal, most likely there's going to be a tab at the top or a label that says business. And when you click on business, we want our site to be the one that is then displayed, and so that's really why the strong partnership, or part of the reason for the strong partnership with the other agencies. We said all along this cannot just be a Secretary of State effort, because then it's just another silo. So we want to make sure that all the business agencies and contacts are represented. We want to make sure that it's very prominent that this is the information that as soon as you click that tab, you're right into this new site, this new portal, and then able to take advantage of all the services that are available.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a comment. I just think this is really an exciting marriage of technology and creativity. It's been the holy grail, and I did say that as a joke, although it is actually true about Governor Straub and probably Governor McCaul before him. So it has been the holy grail, and I just want to commend you. I just came from chaired another hearing where your auditing division was also contributing some of their creativity. And so I just wanted to give some kudos here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, thank you for that. And I'll stand corrected, though I would probably still argue with you over a glass of wine about which governor on that one. But I will say, I think what we've seen, and at least what I've seen since I've been Secretary of State, is one of the reasons why we've been successful is that we're building these projects incrementally and in phases. So, for example, the Central Business Registry I talked about, we're implementing phase 4 of that. Phase 1 and 2, I think, were before I was on board. So they're done in a small scale. We test them rigorously to make sure that we can be successful and work really hard to reduce risks as we move forward. So I think that's one of the reasons why we've been successful in these technology projects. And I anticipate, Peter talked about rolling out in June 2012. Well, that's, I think, the beginning. It's like we'll be building on layer after layer after that. So I'm really excited about this project as well.
Senator Girard?
Another question I would have is, we've talked about for-profits, and do we do anything for nonprofits, like the Girl Scouts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I do everything for the Girl Scouts that I can possibly do.
I know you do.
I am now an honorary Girl Scout. Yes, I am.
So I'm impressed with that.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. A couple questions. One, I'm deeply interested in the Secretary of State's condo living in a sub-portal, I think. Is
that a portal within a portal, Mr. Chair?
A portal
Chair,
within
Mr.
a portal.
Vice Chair.
First for Peter. Peter, are you, as the Secretary of State corporate division, barred by law from including chambers of commerce into your portal?
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, I don't know the answer to that. We'll have to look that up and get back to you. We do have, top of my head, I want to say no, because you know, we consider the chambers and the various communities a key partner for us. We have an outreach program where we go out and do training and work with groups in the local communities. You know, we frequently try to get out to the chambers of commerce and engage them and talk about, you know, the services that we have to offer and also solicit their input on how we can improve services, what information advice they have for us. So I think that
business wizard.
Yeah, we have an online business wizard, which is a sort of an educational tool, and I believe we have chambers of commerce listed in there, so that, you know, we try to because they provide such a great resource to the business community. We do try to get them help people get in contact. You know, maybe they don't know that there's a chamber there, you know, that does outstanding work, you know, in the community of Roseburg or Salem or wherever they happen to be. You know, we try to help make those contacts and facilitate that so that people have access to all those informations. We do a lot of work with the small business development centers trying to get the people to, you know, to contact and engage them, and whether it's SEDCOR or SCORE or some of the other groups as well.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, my recollection from being on the Business Wizard, and it's been a few months since I've been on there, I always go on and try and create a business and see what resources I'm able to access. My recollection is that I could contact the local chamber in the area that I was starting a business in. So I believe there's no prohibition in us connecting with the chambers, and I think it's a really important part of what we do.
Thank you. I think it'd be pretty easy, especially just connecting the address to the zip code to the wherever. My next is a question, Mr. Chair, is actually more of a statement, and that is that I was one of your customers 2 months ago. I went and incorporated a business through the portal, and the first thing that I did was I got online, and then I said, hey, this is actually a test for me to see how good customer service is. So I said no. And I called a real-life human being and asked really questions that I knew the answer to, and just to see. And your staff was fantastic, just completely clean. How may we help you? Super professional. It was like, well, if you're thinking, if I forget what I asked, but there, well, you need to consider this, 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 and this, and this. Very thorough, very professional, and very seamless. So congratulations.
I appreciate that. I'll pass the sentiments on to the folks at our call center.
Yeah, they did great.
They'll appreciate that.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I also encourage you to go online to check out the Business Wizard to see if you can access, I don't know what your business was, a fabulous bicycle racing shop or something. You could access on the Business Wizard some of the resources that you might be able to need, that you might need and use in your new business. So,
one more follow-up question for the Secretary. Would your opening comment about Senator Edwards make him like third to me? Like, if you were my daughter, that's my grandson. Kind of
thing. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I didn't want to use the Rodell Youth Leadership Program because I'm sure everybody was going to wonder why I had actually attended that particular program. So, yes. I think you were the initial appointee from Oregon, as I recall.
The only one west of Texas.
Okay. All right.
And are there other questions?
Keeping us focused, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I wish you well, and I strongly encourage you as you go down there to please use the focus groups and real business people. Having been involved in creating some of these, it's the IT people can get really interested in things that make no sense to people.
So that's something that we're trying to do more of, and especially utilize customer feedback.
Last one to the Secretary, sort of following up on him, is it's really great to direct people to the right resources. Let's hope when they get to the right resources, those people help.
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we'll move on to our next option, and that would be industrial lands. And Patrick, do you have any introductory comments?
No, Mr. Chair, this is a project that I know that is of special interest to you. I believe some of the panelists may touch on at least one bill that was addressed by this committee during session, Senate Bill 766, but since that process is just getting going, they will be speaking more generally, I believe, but they'll probably touch on that as well. So,
Mr. Whitman and everybody else. Thank you for coming, Richard. This is really sort of, as you well know, my favorite topic, and it really gets to as we're trying to prepare the state, hopefully, as we get out of this economic malaise, some place where people can land business and deal with that. And I will say at the start, I want to praise Richard for all of his hard work on Senate Bill 66. He did a wonderful job with that, and we didn't get everything we wanted, but we did pretty good, and I think it is too early to expect anything out of that. But what I'm particularly interested in, and I hope the committee is what's happening in the other areas. I know in your former position before you took on the act, are you still acting, or did you lose that title and you're permanent now?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, I'm still acting and in the governor's office. That's correct.
Well, I know that you've been working around the state with efforts to deal with that, so I hope you'll be able to help us out.
So, again, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I am going to give you a brief update on implementation of Senate Bill 766 because the agencies involved in that effort have been working hard on implementation of that important legislation, directed at assuring that we can do everything possible to incent important industrial development projects within our urban areas. If you'll recall briefly, there are two main parts to Senate Bill 766. One is a focus on projects of statewide significance in terms of industrial development, basically a way of fast-tracking the state and local permitting regulatory process for job-creating projects around the state. That has been the focus, that part of the bill has been the focus of the agency's work over the last several months on implementation, and we're pretty far along in detailing how that's going to work, to the point that we have just recently sent out invites to the work group that put together that legislation to do a briefing for them on where we're at and get their feedback before we get too far down the road to make sure that we're proceeding in a way that's consistent with what their expectations were. But we expect that that part of the bill will be ready and up and running by the end of this calendar year. The second part of the legislation authorizes the designation of regionally significant industrial areas where, again, permitting for industrial uses within those areas is expedited. That'll be the second car in this train in terms of implementation. We're starting to turn attention to that part of the bill, but the first order of priority was to get the project part of the bill online quickly. So that's been the focus so far. We haven't run into any unexpected problems in terms of implementation so far, so I think the word, although it's early, is everything looks good so far. The Economic Recovery Review Council, which is the five agency directors who meet and make decisions on the projects in the areas of regional significance, have had their first meeting. The second meeting of that group is scheduled. Staff are meeting on a weekly basis on implementation from all five agencies, working as a team to do the implementation on 766 Business Oregon. Staff are taking the lead on that effort. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you've got about 766.
You had any tire kicking from either Oregon as local governments or potential businesses?
Not, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, not specifically yet. We have had some general discussions about types of businesses that might be most suitable to take advantage of the expedited permitting for the projects, and We're currently trying to identify several specific sectors that where development activity is taking place right now that we think could be appropriate for that vehicle. Okay. So,
any questions of the committee on that? Seeing none. Go ahead.
So, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I think we've got several specific topic areas that we were going to talk about today. One is to talk about the, and the focus here really is on the land use part of economic development. The first issue that we were going to talk about is land availability for large industrial sites and how they're dispersed, and to talk a little bit about efforts that have been undertaken in a couple of specific areas of the state, those being the Portland metro area with the urban and rural reserves effort, and then to also talk about the Jackson County regional problem-solving effort that is coming very close to completion down in Jackson County. So I'm Rob Halliburton, the Planning Services Division Manager from the Department of Land Conservation and Development is here with me, and he's going to kick this off in talking about availability of large sites. So, Rob.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, again, I'm Rob Halliburton. We were given some topics to discuss that Senator Beyer suggested that we touch on to help focus the discussion today, and I'm going to make some brief comments focusing on those suggestions, but I would also invite any questions that you have as I go along. My comments are fairly brief. The first one, as Richard indicated, deals with the availability of large development-ready industrial sites and the how many of those and whether they're geographically dispersed around the state. And I'm afraid I have to tell you we really don't know the answer to that question. DLCD has not been charged with maintaining an inventory of such sites or even of industrial zoning. We're currently in the early stages of an effort to, I guess you could say, modernize our information management capabilities in the department, but we have not been given that charge by the legislature nor the resources to do that, and so, as I'm sure you're more aware than we are the how hard it is to get new programs going in this climate, we are in fact trying to get a better handle on not just industrial sites, but other development-ready sites and zoning around the state. But as of right now, we really don't have a good handle on that. Just even the zoning of industrial lands around the state. And the development-ready, whether a site is development-ready is even harder because it could have the right zoning, but to make a site development-ready depends on a lot of other things that are maybe even more difficult to obtain than the zone, such as the public facilities, the infrastructure, and the environmental permitting and other factors. The closest proxy that we have to an inventory of sites is the Business Oregon's Certified Industrial Sites List. I don't want to talk about that too much there here, and if you have questions about that, they'll be up here later, I believe. But they have there have been, I believe, 71 sites certified around the state as development-ready or shovel-ready. Nearly half of those have already received some level of development. I don't know that those are built out, but it's been a fairly successful program. But it is also dependent on folks applying for it. So there certainly are development ready sites around, around the state that aren't certified. Regarding geographic dispersal, it's the same issue. Since we don't really have the inventory, it's difficult to say how well they are dispersed around the state. I would say that I would like the committee to know that DLCD has a planning grants program, and since 2003, updating local comprehensive plans for economic development has been the highest priority use of our grant funds, and we have funded 81 projects to update local plans to ready cities of comprehensive plans for economic development. But again, the zoning and the planning sometimes is the easy part. But I did want to let you know that we are trying at that level to get cities ready. There have been a variety of UGB amendments around the state over the last few years to bring industrial land into UGB, some of them multiple hundred-acre efforts in Pendleton, for example, Hermiston Metro, and others that have, again, made land ready at the planning level for development. Again, under geographic dispersal on the east side, there's the Port of Morrow properties that you probably know about that are a regionally significant employer here in Salem. The Mill Creek Industrial Area is one that has more or less recently been brought up to readiness for industrial uses. And then Metro has recently done an inventory getting ready for their next urban growth boundary amendment that shows they have an adequate supply of the 25 to 50 acre sites for their planning horizon, but the larger sites, the 50 plus acre sites, they show a deficit. And so as they move forward here in the next few weeks on their urban growth boundary, they anticipate bringing additional land into their urban growth boundary for those large industrial sites. Then I was ready to move forward maybe on some more of the regional efforts. I was going to talk a little bit about Central Oregon, and I think Richard wanted to talk about the Jackson County regional problem solving. In Central Oregon, with a DLCD grant, the three counties and most of the cities in Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties came together in a unique and innovative project to look at their needs and their opportunities for economic development, for particularly industrial development, and did it as a region, did it together, not just one city as is normally done or even one county, but the entire Central Oregon region did what we call an economic opportunities analysis that again covered all three counties and the cities therein, looked at the trends and opportunities for industrial and other employment uses in the region, and the first body that's set to actually adopt that is Deschutes County. It's at the hearing stage with the county right now. The Board of County Commissioners has not adopted that economic opportunities analysis. But it truly is innovative, not just on a planning sense, but also in a governance sense, that they're grappling with some difficult issues on how the governance issues and provision of infrastructure and other services gets provided at the time that a site is to be made ready, and agreement amongst the jurisdictions which sites in which cities are the highest priority for attracting employers, or not highest priority, but the most likely to attract employers. And they're trying to do this ahead of time so that they can move quickly when opportunities for actual development do arise.
So can I stop you just a second? So, since it was a group effort, are each of the affected communities, and I guess the counties as well, going to adopt the economic opportunity analysis as part of their individual comp plans?
Over time, yes. The counties would be the first entities to adopt it, would provide the umbrella framework for the cities, and then as the cities identify opportunities and wish to redesignate land or expand their UGBs, they could do it then or before that.
So is the idea then, by having gone through this process and having a common EOA, that I guess the next step of that is, where it's appropriate and agreed upon, they would do adjustments in their urban growth boundary?
Senator Beyer, yes, that is the intent, to bring industrial sites in as necessary.
Is that assumed to make it easier to get an acknowledgement?
That is the idea, yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. That was, unless there are more questions, that's really what I had on the efforts in Central Oregon. It's still too early in the process to gauge its success, but we do like where it's headed, and we think the region does as well.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about Jackson County?
Okay. Yeah. All right. Richard's asked me to talk about the Jackson County regional problem solving as well. Regional problem solving, we usually use capital letters when we use those words, because regional problem solving is a section of the planning statutes. It is a legal process that a region can engage in that Jackson County is one of several that have chosen to do so. They are the ones that are the closest to actually finishing a regional problem-solving process. In Jackson County, or in the Bear Creek Valley, actually, it's not the whole county. It's the county and, I believe, seven cities in the Bear Creek Valley around Medford have been engaged in a regional planning effort for several years to look at the long-term urban growth potential, not the potential, but to look where they want to grow the urban areas over the next, well, to double the population. It's approximately a 50-year planning horizon. And for the full range of uses, employment uses, residential, institutional, public, parks, the full gamut of urban uses over the long term. And again, recurring theme, the idea is, and this has some truth in the law, is that it makes it more expedited when a city wants to expand its UGB, when the urban reserves, the long-term planning has been done. I hadn't used that term yet, I guess. That's the ultimate product of the RPS project in this case is urban reserves, so that each city will have identified where it expects to grow, not in the 20-year horizon that the urban growth boundary uses, but the 50-year horizon, and then assuming that they move into that area with the UGB, it's a relatively expedited process. So as I say, and this is has gone through all the cities in Jackson County through the city councils, and has gone through a series of hearings at the Jackson County Planning Commission and is at the Jackson County Board of Commissioners, and we anticipate adoption of the plan later this year. So specifically to industrial lands, it does include specific consideration of the employment lands for the region for the 50-year planning horizon. It doesn't designate lands per se yet. Lands outside the UGB retain a rural plan and zoning designation, but certain areas are identified in the plan as those that are expected to eventually become employment sites. One of the questions we were asked to address was more specific, and that was an employer in Jackson County, a large employer in Jackson County, Erickson Air Crane. Apparently there has been some suggestion that they're looking to move out of the area or out of the state. I've talked to the city and the county and the Business Oregon's regional business development officer for the area. I haven't talked to anyone from the company. I hesitate to say very much anecdotally about one firm when we're primarily here to talk at a much higher level on industrial lands availability. I am prepared to say that no one at the city or county had been approached about alternative sites for Erickson Air Crane to move to. They do own a 40-acre site already in White City. I don't know if they actually have any operation going on there now or not, but they do have that site. It's not adjacent to their existing site. The existing site is actually outside an urban growth boundary. It's in an industrial zone outside, or it's in a rural industrial zone surrounded by exclusive farm use land, and that does propose, or it presents a different set of considerations if they want to expand the industrial zoning than if they were inside the UGB. To my knowledge,
is it on exception land?
Yes, it is. There's been an exception to the exclusive farm, to the Goal 3, and it's been planned and zoned for industrial use.
Is the surrounding land,
everything
adjacent land
is
also in an exception area?
No. Everything around it is exclusive farm use. Mm. So as I say, that does present you a different set of challenges for expansion, but at the same time, to our knowledge, there hasn't been any effort to, in fact, do so. In my conversations with the business development officer from Business Oregon, he'd made a statement that, you know, we all know that's hard to convert from EFU to industrial. And I'm not going to argue with that. We do know it's hard. I would point out, however, that it has been done successfully in many sites around the state. And one case I would like to point out is a few years ago, there was a firm called Treasure Valley Renewable Resources that wanted to site a plant in rural Malheur County. And they identified their priority site was in an exclusive farming zone outside the city of Ontario. And the department provided technical assistance to Treasure Valley and to Malheur County to finish the Goal 3 exception and get the site zoned industrial. And we also helped with the LUBA appeal, and it was preserved on appeal, and that exception went through. I only bring this up because to say that until Ericsson or any other rural industrial use went through the process, we can't say whether it's going to work or not. And I believe that an exception to Goal 3 for an industrial use, if the justification is there, shouldn't be a problem. But there are also many, many issues that are outside our control. I'll be the first to admit that as well. So you'd ask, I don't know if that satisfactorily answers any questions you might have had. And I can imagine Senator Atkinson probably knows more about this than I do, and I hope I haven't butchered it too badly. But that's what I've found.
Well, Rob, I appreciate the work you've done. You obviously ran some trap lines on it. And I heard about it during the session, and I can't remember if Senator Atkinson brought it up or not. The others did. And most recently, as I mentioned to you before, the person who brought it up to me was a Medford City Councilor and the head of the Chamber of Commerce down there and their Economic Development Council. So I'm a little surprised at some of the response that you got. Not that you're getting back, but what you got there. I don't usually like to talk about specific companies in public setting, but I know that's a significant industry down there, and it's certainly worth, with all the stuff we're trying to do to make Oregon a better place to do business, if there is some reality there, it's worth a call from somebody relatively high placed in the governor's office to make a call to the company and see if there's something we could do.
We'll find out. And Senator Beyer, I will say we have reached out to the business development officer and to the county to offer any assistance that we can.
Appreciate that. More?
So I think if there are questions, we'll hold
just
for that.
Excuse me, Richard.
Yeah.
Senator Edwards?
I'm going back to the metro area. I have a question about the metro area. So
now's the time.
Right now? Okay. You mentioned that in the metro area, you seem to have an adequate supply of 25 to 50 acre sites, but a shortage of larger parcels. And so, the words shortage and adequate are very qualitative. And so I'm wondering, in whose opinion and what type of methodology do you use to reach that conclusion? Do you have a model based on, you ought to have this much for this size of population, or are you out talking with realtors and economic development folks and stuff like that and, about success in placing people on sites?
I've read that stuff.
I have.
Go ahead. Chair Beyer, Senator Edwards. You're absolutely right. It is a qualitative assessment. In this case, the work, I was quoting Metro's conclusions, and they have done considerable analysis of trends, national, state, and local trends on employment. They have done considerable work on focus groups, the interviews that you asked about, and an analysis of historic trends in the metro region itself. And probably the most in-depth analysis that I've seen come from Metro or any other jurisdiction in the state as they're going through the consideration of the urban growth boundary. But it is still a guess as to what is going to be happening in the future. And different people certainly have different ideas of what's likely and desirable in the future. But Metro has done a considerable amount of work, but the conclusions that I reported are those from Metro.
Okay, thank you. Senator Gerard.
Oh, thank you. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about land use and infrastructure. And I think that the crossover between those two is paramount. And if I give you an example, this is something out of the hat, aluminum manufacturer, you have to have power, you have to have rail, and you have to have water. And then you'd cross that with all the the sites that are available in the state, and there's hardly anything, if there is anything. So I was just kind of wondering if we're starting, if we could go past just the land use part and go to where the availability of the infrastructure is going to be paramount to most really good industry.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, the Senate Bill 766, the second part, which I alluded to very briefly in my opening remarks, directs the five agencies together to designate 15 regionally significant industrial areas in the state. And the idea behind that legislation is exactly what you were just describing in terms of looking for those places in the state that have that intersection of key infrastructure or other key competitive aspects of that particular geography that make them suitable to focus efforts on to bring new industry and new jobs to the state. So the immediate response on that is from a statewide perspective, and this is in addition to what is going on at the local level, to really try to jumpstart development in those 15 areas where you've got that intersection of infrastructure and land use and all the other things that go into creating new business. In addition, and this is a good transition to really the last point that we wanted to talk about, which is what else you got in terms of ideas for job creation, particularly in the land use infrastructure arena. And I want to talk a little bit specifically about a little bit more about the metro work that has gone on in the last couple of years, the Portland metro work, and the Jackson County Bear Creek regional problem solving work. And I've got some pictures are always worth 100 words or 1,000 words. I can't remember what the metric is, but I do have some pictures for you that I'm going to hand out.
Yeah, that'd be great. With your
badge. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, why don't you leave me one, though? So as those are getting handed out, what I want to talk about is just at a high level here, what we as a state do in terms of planning to assure that we've got adequate land, adequate infrastructure for new industrial jobs to be created. Already in state law, we require that cities have an adequate land supply for employment opportunities. That's the base requirement that's in state law. And the larger cities in the state are required periodically to go through a review of whether they in fact have an adequate amount of land or not. More recently in the state, we've started in some of the larger urban areas to develop this concept of urban reserves. And I want to talk about that because I think it provides some opportunities for what we might be able to do to plan for both land and infrastructure investment to make sure that we have that alignment that gives every possible incentive for job creation. The reason that urban reserves are important is, right now in state law, we have this hierarchy of what lands can be added to urban growth boundaries. As I think you all know from reading the paper, expanding an urban growth boundary can be very complicated. Tends to be very litigious. It takes a lot of time. So the main tool that we have right now to deal with that is this urban reserve concept. Because once a local government has an urban reserve in place, it has answered the question of where they're going to expand. You're not fighting about that part of the analysis anymore. The only question you have to answer to bring additional land into the urban growth boundary is there a need for the land? And so if you can show that there actually is a need for additional land for employment, then you can bring in any land within the urban reserve area, and you don't get into a fight about where, which is where a lot of the litigation tends to occur. So Portland Metro has just gone through this effort for a 50-year urban and rural reserves, which is the first large map that I've handed out. They have just completed a designation of 28,000 acres of land as urban reserves as a pool to draw from as that area grows over the next 50 years. The Land Conservation and Development Commission approved that decision by Metro in August of this year. And so Metro is now following that up with an urban growth boundary amendment using those urban reserves specifically to add large lot industrial sites to the Portland Metro urban growth boundary. So that process is happening this fall. The same thing, hopefully, will occur down in the Bear Creek Valley area when and I won't say if, but when Jackson County finally approves the regional problem-solving plan that's been underway there for quite some time. They will have a pool of lands that they can draw from for urban growth boundary expansions by the cities in that region, and they won't have to fight about the where question. They'll only have to show that there is, in fact, a need. So now transitioning to what can we do? In terms of potentially some additional ideas to work on, I'll offer up two specific things. One is absolutely, as Senator Girard has said, infrastructure is really key here. Local government is struggling with how to provide the infrastructure necessary to develop lands that are added to urban growth boundaries. We've got several examples that have been in the news in the Portland metro area where land has been added to that region's urban growth boundary and it hasn't urbanized because local government can't pay for the roads and the sewer and the water that's needed to serve that land. So specifically working on legislation to put in place the tools that are needed to finance infrastructure in newly urbanizing areas, I think with a particular focus or an incentive to use this urban reserve tool is one idea that a number of people have this is not my idea, it's not nothing new. A number of people have talked about as something that they think we could make progress on in the relatively near future. The urban reserves, I think, also provide an opportunity for a second idea that people have talked about as well, which is the concept of if you have a fish on the hook of an important prospective employer, either an expansion of an existing business or a new business that is ready to commit to come to an area but needs land that can't be found within an urban growth boundary. If we can figure out a rapid response mechanism using urban reserves to get a decision made to bring that land in quickly and the infrastructure arrangements as well so that we can respond to that fish on the hook, that's the other concept that we've talked about with a number of local government partners over the last couple of years. So, Chair Beyer, I am willing to work with whatever group of people are interested in working on those or other concepts of how we can make sure that our land use system is playing its part in terms of providing the land necessary for employment creation and doing so in an efficient, cost-effective way for our local governments. We had a work group leading up to the 11th session. We'd be very happy to work with that or some other similar group on some of these ideas.
Has staff, either at Biz Oregon or in the DLCD, looked at what other states are doing around infrastructure financing?
The most recent effort on infrastructure finance has actually been at the local government level. Michael Jordan, in his prior capacity, had convened a group of private sector individuals to work on this problem from the private sector perspective. And I think there's some opportunity to pick up on the work that's been done there, as well as look at whether there are tools from other states that we could implement here in Oregon. Most of the tools that exist, certainly in California, exist in some form in Oregon. We have some limitations in terms of our Measure 50, Measure 5 constitutional limitations that provide some constraints on what we can do, but there are some limited opportunities in the areas of districts, bonding, I hate to use this word, but urban renewal, those sorts of things that I think are worth looking at.
Not a bad word. It has been used very successfully.
Yes.
other questions?
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Rob, very quickly, has the department ever compared itself to other states in the amount of time it takes to get a decision made?
Senator Byers, Senator Atkinson, not in any systematic way, no.
Do you have a hunch of how we do compared to other states?
I have a hunch that we compare disfavorably to some states and favorably to other states.
Are you running for office?
There are. I'm trying to be honest.
So if I could, Chair Byer, Senator Atkinson. I had the experience of working in California as an economic development professional for 5 years before I came to Oregon, and then worked as a lawyer here in Oregon, obviously on the private side, before I came and worked for state government. So subjectively, I don't have quantitative data on this, but in our sister state to the north, in our sister state to the south, both have state environmental policy acts which require an environmental impact review of some form of any significant development project. And what my experience has been, and what I hear from attorneys who practice in both states, either California and Oregon or Oregon and Washington, is because of the CEPAs, the Washington CEPA and in California CEQA, it tends to be slower for big projects than in Oregon. The advantage we have in Oregon is the statutory timeline. If there is there's a statutory timeline for local land use decisions, and there's a statutory timeline for LUBA appeals that has resulted in relatively quick decisions. I would agree with Rob, though, that if you go to some other states, maybe Idaho, you might find that on average decisions get made more rapidly.
Senator, I would answer your question from my past experience, although it's about a decade dated now. When I was working in the field, that if siting consultants, the people who work with the businesses, generally like Oregon's land use system, and what they would generally say is if there is a site that the business that's already zoned and ready to go, that they loved Oregon's system because it was very clear. They also liked the fact that there wasn't one. It was real clear to them that they weren't going to bother because you couldn't get through the process. Now, I would say that the one caveat to that is our system has grown very litigious. And even good projects, if there's public opposition to them, while you may win in the end, you can string our process out a long time through the courts and just kill a project on that basis. And people who professionally do it know that, and if there's that there, they're just not going to do it.
Rob, I appreciate your comments about Ericsson. Ericsson is actually, they are indeed building, in fact, they're training most of the Italian Air Force firefighters at the new location where they do have a building on that 40 acres. It is not adjacent, and I live actually by the other location that they have, so I'm very familiar. It's very odd because what is zoned EFU can't grow a thing, but that's a debate that those of us from rural Oregon never can win in Portland. But it's truly amazing. You cannot. What zoned, the farms that are there maybe have a chicken, period. So anyway, I do have one quick question for you, Mr. Director, or your Mr. Policy Director. You were saying earlier about maybe exploring the idea of having, if a big fish is on, an expedited system. I fish a lot, so that resonated with me. But because we usually fish the other way around, where we set the stage to catch the fish. That way we catch more fish. But what is the size you're looking at to be expedited? And then the converse part is, well, why not just expedite for everyone?
Chair Byer, Senator Atkinson. I don't have any particular size in mind right now. There is a qualitative size for project, what the projects of state significance in 766, but even there it's scaled to the community. So if it's a small community, obviously a 10-person company in a small community can be very significant. So I think the same would go here, that you'd want to scale it somewhat to the size of the community. In terms of why not expedite it for everyone, I think that's a subject that's worth some more discussion. I think, you know, we're willing to look at certainly ways of expediting the urban growth boundary amendment process. We've had some struggles recently, and we're not going to be ready to talk to you in 2012 about that, but we are talking with the development community and others about some changes to the system that we would bring to you in 2013, the purpose of which would be to significantly speed up the process for urban growth boundary amendments. And so stay tuned on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
May I add to that?
Yeah.
I would like to also point out that cities that keep their comprehensive plans up to date look at what they anticipate for their employment needs over the 20-year horizon and accommodate sites and zoning and infrastructure for those anticipated needs. And I believe that is setting the table and expediting the permitting for what is anticipated, as Senator Beyer mentioned. If it's appropriately zoned and is ready to go, it's fairly efficient in Oregon right now. I believe what we're talking about is those unanticipated opportunities that cities get from time to time. And no matter how good their planning is, opportunities arise that nobody knew were going to come up. And so I think what we're trying to do is find opportunities in the system to handle those unanticipated opportunities better.
My friend. That was a movie line, sorry. My friend. The problem with the Ericsson Aircrane example is that their main headquarters is in Central Point and their new plant is in White City, which most of Southern Oregon views as a place to build industrial land and isn't on the map. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can have one city that's up to date and the adjacent city might not be, and so somewhere the business gets pinched. That's the point. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. And Ms. Oregon, did you have comments on the list?
Sure.
I probably stole most of your thunder already.
Now
I'm hoping that you gentlemen would tell me that you know how many sites are out there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Chesler. I'm the Deputy Director of Business Oregon, but also the Director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. So just a few comments to your concerns about infrastructure being available. Not too many years ago, I was exploring with Washington County as well as Gresham, where do we get essentially patient capital to make that infrastructure investment? And I say patient capital from the perspective that whenever somebody loans money for a community to install an infrastructure, they're looking for payment just as soon as they make that loan, including us as the state. So our exploration was to find a way that we can advance the money so that infrastructure is in place, so the opportunity is there, and the repayment of that begins at the point in time when indeed there are then businesses located that are beginning to pay the fees associated with that infrastructure. The challenge still is out there, but the solution is clearly some patient capital that facilitates getting that infrastructure in place. Just some additional comments related to 766 progress. I'll just note that the applicant notice of intent instructions have been drafted. They're ready. What we're trying to do, as Mr. Whitman referenced, be ready for that working group to lay out the process, the timeline, the forms, the format, so that they have an opportunity to go through and see if this meets their expectations. Frankly, a lot of our meetings have been looking at examples in the state, such as the energy siting plant program, and identifying how much of that is too much to expect from somebody when they submit their NOI information. And I think we've pared it back to a nice couple pages of information that we want, or at least that's the list of information we want. That's pared back significantly. And the other thing that we've been exploring clearly in the bill, there's a 120-day clock that starts ticking when a complete application is submitted. We have explored with the Attorney General's office information related to how can we stop that clock. Not that we want to stop that clock, but through the course of development, if a developer identifies that what they have proposed no longer fits their situation, how can they stop the clock, amend their application, so, and begin the clock again? And I think we've reached an agreement in how we can proceed in that sense as well. So
how different would that be, Lynn, then? I know you have a similar clock for land use decisions, which essentially, out of practice, what the local government tends to say to an applicant is, you can extend this voluntarily and we can deal with that, or if you would like to keep the clock going as it exists now, your answer is going to be no.
Chair Beyer, the analogy is very clear and very similar, I should say. What we were concerned with is the bill says a decision will be made in 120 days if the applicant elects to stop the clock because he knows it's going to be a no decision because of changes in what he's proposing or needs to change in his development effort. We want to make sure that he could stop the clock rather than us having to run the clock out to say no and collect his fee.
I'll give you another precedent. At the Public Utility Commission, utilities make an application for a tariff change, and the law as it's written says that if the commission doesn't act within 30 days, the tariff as proposed is approved. Almost never does it happen in 30 days, and it's usually because of various interveners. But same situation there. It can voluntarily be extended, and it's been upheld by the courts many times if the applicant does it, agrees to it.
Mm-hmm. So with that, I'll let Mike give you a summary of his observations about industrial sites.
The keeper of the inventory.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Williams. I'm the industrial land specialist for Business Oregon. There was a question about do we have an adequate inventory. I think the way you address whether you have an adequate inventory is to look at supply and demand and then to see if you have a surplus or an excess of inventory. In terms of looking at the demand, which hasn't been talked a lot about today yet, Business Oregon is now tracking opportunities that come through our shop that have specific site requirements. And we have some statistics that we have been collecting since June of 2010, and those statistics say that 4% of the requirements that state and acreage want 100 acres or more, and that up to 11% of the opportunities that come through our shop that we document and get into our database want an acreage of 50 acres or more. So there's clearly demand in the state for these large acreages. Also, some of the industries that have been asking for 100 acre plus sites have been advanced manufacturing, solar, data centers, and distribution centers. All those sectors have wanted more than 100 acres. And then in the 30 acres or greater category, we have some green energy companies, wood products companies, and our catch-all other category have wanted sites over 30 acres. So there's a demand out there for the requested 30-acre or greater sites. Now, do we have the inventory for that? Well, it's a big state. We have a lot of regions. A lot of regions are doing different things in determining do they have the right inventory and is that inventory ready. Metro's done their study. There's another working group that's working right now that I think is really doing a state-of-the-art study in the metro area. That's headed up by the Port Business Oregon. Metro is part of the working group, Portland Business Alliance. And we've also gotten the cooperation of the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. And they bring a lot of private sector expertise. That study is going to be released soon. I think what you're going to find is that that study is going to find that there's 15 sites, 25 acres or more, that are considered ready in 180 days in the metro area. So we can talk about whether that's an over or under supply. I think you would get multiple opinions. In the area over 100 acre sites, we only have one site in the metro area that's considered ready to go in 180 days in the 100 acres and over category right now. So there's definitely a need for more of those sites if we're going to be market competitive. And we're looking at about six sites, plus or minus, in the 50-acre category. I contend if you drive down I-5 that the only other 100-acre home run opportunity between Portland and Eugene would probably be at Mill Creek. There are some opportunities in Lebanon and Albany that could accommodate 100 acres, but it would depend on their wetland status and probably a pretty difficult permitting regime. But some of those, I believe, could get through depending on where they are with their delineations and sort of the wetlands work that they're doing. And in regards to that wetlands work, we're working really hard on 20 sites in Lynn and Benton, doing a regional general permit. Today, actually, there's a bus tour going on where members of DLCD, DSL, Business Oregon, and the communities are taking a bus tour with the Corps of Engineers. We've had a lot of trouble handing off sort of wetlands permitting to the feds, and there's a real good innovative process going on that was funded by a strategic reserve fund funding that's going on in order to speed up that whole handoff of the state permitting, which is generally done in the 120 days over to the feds and the Corps of Engineers. So that's real exciting. If I could just also comment on the Central Oregon, the Economics Opportunities Analysis, Business Oregon has been very supportive of that. We think it makes a lot of sense. It actually makes so much sense because they're looking at a specific industry need, they're looking at specific sites, and they're looking at it in a regional context. It makes so much sense. I kind of had a hard time explaining to our commission why that's such a radical approach for us. But we're getting there, and we're confident that this could be a great new model for looking at industrial lands and industrial opportunities across the state. And one more comment about Metro. They do the urban and rural reserves process, and I believe right now the recommendation that's on the table is about 300 acres in Hillsboro for additional land. So that's sort of the current Metro recommendation. I believe the city of Hillsboro is asking for maybe 600 acres or so. And I believe that's most of the industrial or employment land that's on the table for this round of UGB expansions.
You used some statistics there. They're mostly in percentages. I guess I'd be interested at some point in knowing about that and actual numbers of companies that had requested that.
Yeah, we have that, and I've got five or six copies of that with
me.
Yeah.
And the other one was how many businesses can you talk about? I want to know which ones, but have we lost some because we didn't have land?
We don't have formal documentation of that.
We've been told professional assessment.
That's part of a list of reasons why we have lost recruitments. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why you lose recruitments. The thing about land availability is a lot of recruitments pass over us and we don't even know it. I mean, they don't necessarily always contact us. There's lots of ways to get lots of information about land from Oregon right. Prospector, LoopNet, Brokers, CoStar. And if they don't see the sites in those venues, Business Oregon doesn't even get asked. So that's a difficult thing to prove or not prove.
I'm pleased that you know a little bit more about it.
Yeah, the opportunity tracking.
I think you need to spend more time talking with Rob's shop.
The opportunity tracking has been a real good tool. And we plan to use it in a lot of different ways.
Often you learn more about the ones you lost than the ones you got.
Right.
Questions? Well, my quick summary from what I'm hearing from you is that we don't have enough land. And we probably need to do a better job of that, and we probably need to find a way to, for those that we do have, to get through the regulatory hoops, which I'm assuming is mainly wetlands. Sounds like you're working on that. And financing. And I would hope, I think maybe we ought to talk about whether we ought to put together an interim work group just looking at that. I suspect we couldn't do anything by 12, but maybe we can by 13. looking at what other states have done, what ideas come out of the metro area.
Mr. Chair, I would welcome that. As I've said, patient capital is the term I think we want to use here, and to what degree can we advance capital to make sure infrastructure is in place and replace it then when there are indeed businesses located on that property, essentially refinance that advance of funding and then revolve that funding to another site as the improved site now pays for its own way.
Okay. And do you have recommendations for us other than the ones that Mr. Whitman's offered?
Just that fine-tuning of the advancement of money for infrastructure.
Well, we will be looking for specific ideas from you. We're not the experts in that area. So provide us with some options that you think we might be able to do, and we'll try to do what we can.
Okay.
Other questions? Alan? Thank you very much. Okay. And I think we're up to our final panel, which has to deal with
money.
Access to business capital. Money, Senator Atkins' favorite topic. Patrick, any introductory comments?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I believe we're going to have a series of three panels. The first one will be some folks from Business Oregon. We have a panel of three folks from there. The second panel will be representatives of the Oregon Bankers Association. I believe Tim Martinez has brought a couple folks from that organization with him. And then the third and betting cleanup will be the state treasurer, I believe, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Lynn and Paul, I think you guys you're back up again. We could have just kept you here.
Once again, my name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Deputy Director of Business Oregon. Just as a quick reminder, I was going to run through very briefly what our department does related to business finance. We've talked about it before, but again, to remind you, we're involved with both direct lending and loan guarantees that we work with then local banks. On the direct lending side, we have the Oregon Business Development Fund. That's for larger loans. It's for traded sector. Terry Hagley is with us here today, and he's one of the loan officers that works in that program. We also have the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, which is much smaller money. This morning we were again in front of a committee where we had some of those small business owners who take advantage of this very limited capital, but it's quite flexible and easily accessible for those small businesses when they don't have that track record that they need in order to access the Oregon Business Development Fund. And then for the largest developments, we also have an industrial development bond program, which is the $2-3 million and greater financings that we work in tandem with banks on and their businesses they deal with. On the loan guarantee side, we have the Credit Enhancement Fund. As it's reflected, it is a loan guarantee, assures losses up to 85 or 90%. We have a capital access program, which is a pool of funds that we match with local banks so that indeed the loan they make, if it has a problem being repaid, they can tap into our funds as well as their own to cover their losses. One of the things I did want to reflect to you, our success, that we were approved by the U.S. Treasury for the $16 million of the Small Business Credit Initiative that we've talked about before. That money should be available to us. I think the first deposit's coming through the first of next month, and we'll be putting that towards our business development fund. A substantial part of it's going to the guarantee fund because, frankly, as Terry can reflect to you, the guarantee fund has exploded with interest in the recent months. It's amazing. Banks are anxious to get back in business, but they want that guarantee. Small businesses are beginning to borrow again, so that program has been well received, and we're putting a substantial amount of money towards that. With that, I'll turn it over to Wes, who's on our agency's finance committee. They're the folks that review the loans that we make, and Wes certainly has a perspective as a private businessman from Central Oregon and can talk about what he's seeing in some of the activities he's been reviewing for us as departments work.
Thanks, Lynn. And again, I'm Wes Price. I'm a CPA from Bend, Oregon. And you know that little spot over there on the other side of the hill. But I'm also not on the
big
state
spot.
Payroll. So, you know, for, you know, being able to come before you guys, I really appreciate that. So, Senator Beyer, I appreciate being able to speak before your committee. And Senator Atkinson and I know each other from a long time back. It's when I had more hair. But when he first ran, we were actually serving on a board of a not-for-profit together way back when, called Sparrow Clubs.
Which just won, the person who was our ED just had the extreme makeover of their house last week in Medford.
Perfect.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
The 200th anniversary two-hour special will be featuring Sparrow Clubs.
Oh, that's terrific.
And so everyone listening, go to... No, just kidding.
No. What I wanted to do a quick update on is John Saris with the department and I did a quick update on the programs and what's working and what and kind of the a few things that aren't working as well to the commission on July 15th over in Prineville when the commission met over there. They were over there to tour Facebook because that's kind of a nice profile one to go through. But the bottom line is that the programs that we're seeing the quickest and most effective job creation are in the OBDF and the Credit Enhancement Fund. Those two are quickly levered up into job creation. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that as a committee we discussed, because just last week we met as a committee and talked about some of you know, how to potentially change some of the loan requirements and whatnot to be able to deploy capital. We do have capital to deploy from the OBDF, and it is, we're seeing a lot of activity in it. Those are direct loans, as Lynn described, and that is what the main piece of what the Finance Committee, of which I'm a part of, oversees. The one thing you need to know also as a Senate Oversight Committee is the Business Oregon staff are being very effective in the field right now. The BDOs, particularly in the rural areas, are incredibly visible and are helping to get the word out that, you know, we're open for business. And through that, there's been a substantial amount of activity through the OBDF in rural areas of the state. And then along with that, like Terry is, there's the staff here in Salem with the loan specialists are also very professional and they get the job done quick, which is huge in trying to do this. Our current committee consists of three bankers and two business people, and we're going to add a third business member to that, the ranks of the committee, sometime in the next 60 days. In the oversight capacity of reviewing these OBDF loans as they've come in, during the last 2 years, the credit quality of the borrowers that are coming to the OBDF program is dramatically better than it was 5 years ago. And you kind of say, what's that got to do with anything? And what it is that's still reflective of the tight credit market because these credits that are coming through the OBDF process now, we never would have seen. Those would have been bankable. They would have just been gone through the normal banking system, and I'm sure the OBA folks will have something to add to that whole deal. So, you know, that's the cause and effect. You know, during the recession, our credit quality improves, and so as a result, the OBDF has a historic low loss ratio right now. And so as a committee, we questioned, are we doing too good a job? In other words, we're not getting, you know, out enough credits. But the reality is it's just a different kind of credit that's showing up at the moment. And so we've vetted that out pretty extensively in our committee meeting and decided that we'd be very cautious about getting on that very slippery slope of changing the credit criteria in the OBDF. It has been a remarkably effective program, and we don't want to do anything at all to jeopardize that. There's actually a very small amount of state money that was there to originally charge this, and then there was a couple of additional pops that came in from the feds on economic development efforts. But what was originally a $10 million deal is now a $41 million project, you know, with loans revolving and getting back out. With the credit still tight with the banks, because Central Oregon has a big black X drawn out right now anyway because of our wonderful real estate gig that we went through. And that boom-bust cycle has created a lot of stress in our local community banking structure. But one of the things that we're seeing is that the community banks are willing to loan, but there's still tight regulatory issues. They have liquidity to deploy, but they're having trouble getting it deployed, and that's where the Credit Enhancement Fund is a big deal. And this, and what Lynn talked about with this charge of additional $10 million, that will be levered as much as 16 times. I mean, it's the equivalent of about $160 million in loans by the time you do the credit assurance that can go along with that. It is the quickest way to get money deployed because it's really our banking partners, the private side, that are getting a boost to be able to loan or have a partial loan guarantee that allows quick deployment of capital. And it should, you know, help kind of kickstart us. And it's, so the committee overviews OBDF and IDBs. There's fewer of those, but the Credit Enhancement Fund is one other area where there will now be some committee oversight. We're going to write up some administrative rule to go along with that. That has typically been a staff-only exercise. And with opening up the program on a little wider bandwidth, it made sense to have an additional oversight, you know, because we've got talented bankers on the committee and they understand how the program works.
Wes, won't that slow it down?
No. And here's why. The turnaround is going to end up being very quick. The staff is working on an inside of a week turnaround on the loan guarantee program. And then we're going to set a threshold for staff to do most of the loans. And anything that's a little bit larger, there can be an ad hoc committee, not the full committee, the bankers that are on the committee, to then take a quick review of the information and not have to convene a meeting to do so. So it will keep the turnaround, maybe adding a day or two at the worst.
So I guess I would ask a question. If it was working well before with staff approvals, why do you need to add?
The anticipation is that there will be some larger projects that will come through. And so
when you do that, then if you were going to break it, set a level where the staff can approve it, then anything over that would have to go to a committee?
Correct.
Is that what you're going to do?
Yes.
Okay.
And part of the deal is that our exposure to a hit on the fund.
I get it.
Is
I thought you were talking about doing them though.
No. That was immediately discussed in the finance committee structure, and we do not want to slow this down. We want to make sure that everything moves quickly, efficiently, and there were some interesting staff discussion on how to streamline the process internally as well. And it's getting better each time. So that is going to be a very important program. The other one that was mentioned, too, is the EDLF, which is a small working capital loan. That is totally staff-administered. And that has been very effective. There's been a lot of activity in that area. So what it begged the question is there's one program that is lagging behind in an activity level, and that's the Boost program. Mm. And part of what that is not the program itself, it's the terms. There are statutory terms that are in the Boost program that make it unattractive to a small business. It's a four-year payback, and it's not so much interest rate issues or that kind of thing. It's that that compresses and increases the cash outflow on a monthly basis for a business who's looking for working capital. And so that would be one consideration that, you know, from the Finance Committee and then also from the staff in administering this program, that we consider a change to maybe, rather than statutorily stating the term, is allowed to be set by administrative rule so that we can have some flexibility to be able to alter those terms as conditions warrant. So that would be a recommendation that came out of our retreat that we were anxious to get before you guys.
Can I back you up just a second? You said the small working capital, is that part of the BDF?
The OBD, no.
BDF?
Mr. Chair, it's a separate fund unto itself. Entrepreneurial Development Loan
Fund. Oh, it's the Entrepreneurial Fund. Well, how do you define small working?
What's the threshold, Terry?
50,000 maximum.
Right.
For the EDLF.
The loans that the Finance Committee actually looks at are in excess of 250. That's the current review threshold, is that if the staff has an OBDF project that is under that, it can be administratively handled without the committee. And then
that's the guarantee?
That's the OBDF, the Business Development Loan Fund. And the guarantee, we're looking at a couple different thresholds, and it was going to be based on a review of the activity that's been in the CEF in the last several months in particular, with the idea that we set a reasonable threshold that the staff takes on. And then if there's larger projects, then those are the ones that would go to our review subcommittee.
Okay, Senator Starr.
Thank you. So I'm looking on the website and reviewing these as we're going, which is kind of convenient to have a computer up here. Number of the loan requirements, the applications must show that the business can provide good and sufficient collateral for the loan. That potentially could be very difficult in this environment. Do you look at the principles per se as personal residence or personal capital, or you know,
what is all of the above?
Yeah. So, is that, talk a little bit about what you look at as far as collateral, because I think that would be an issue.
What I'll do is I'll have Terry talk about how they put a program, or because when the committee sees a loan. By the time it gets to the level where we're reviewing it as a loan committee, every package looks the same, and it goes through the same rigorous internal review process, and that includes vetting out the collateral and then also you know, some assessment of the value of the collateral, because it can say one thing on a personal balance sheet, it might mean something else. So I'll let Terry talk on that for a second.
For the record, my name is Terry Hagley. I'm the lead finance officer for Business Oregon. The statutes and rules say that they need to be secured with good and sufficient collateral, as you indicated. Generally speaking, we looked at that as being on a one-to-one basis. In other words, you know, a dollar of collateral value for a dollar of loan, which is somewhat more liberal than most commercial lending institutions would have. Usually you're going to look at a significantly higher margin than that. But the Finance Committee does have some latitude to alter that up or down, so that, you know, if it's a good project, you obviously weigh out the credit considerations, cash flow, all of the other aspects of the package, and then factor into that the collateral support that's needed to offset some of the other risks that are there. Does that help answer your question?
The other side of it is too, is that there is an out in this whole process that, you know, because the other thing it'll say on there too is it's traded sector, and the rationale for traded sector is, you know, as you guys well know, is that's where we get the biggest bang for the dollars in. You know, when we bring a traded sector job in, it circulates somewhere between 6 and 9 times in the economy.
So which ones does it have to be traded sector, all of them, or
the go ahead.
No, not all of them. Oregon Business Development Fund does. Okay. The Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund does not.
Okay. Slick. Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. On the Credit Enhancement Fund, I think you might have touched on it already, but I missed it. What's the how loaned out is that fund? I mean, do you have lots of headroom still, or?
Well, go ahead. You got the report.
as a loan guarantee fund, it's not a dollar in the fund equals a dollar you can loan out. I mean, you can leverage it up. We've generally looked at it as being a 3 to 4 times multiplier. If we've got $500 million or $500,000 in there, we could loan $2 million basically against that. The loss ratios have been very good on the fund, so we're in good shape there.
So, follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
So my follow-up to that is, do you ever say, given that your loss ratios are at historic lows, do you ever say, this is, the credit is too good on this project, it doesn't necessarily meet the public purpose of this loan, and send it back to the bank and say, stop sending us this, you know, really pristine, these pristine projects, because it's too good?
Yeah. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, that's a great question, and frankly, it is a question that we regularly ask on projects. Are we needed in this deal? And if we're asked to be in the project, usually by a bank or by the borrower, we try and say, okay, what's our contribution here? But we do push back on occasion and say, you know, why are we needed in here? Is there a better place we can deploy the funds?
The infamous but-for provision.
But-for provision, exactly. Yeah.
Then my final follow-up is, and you know, maybe anecdotally you could comment on this. I think we're going to have testimony from the banks as well. Perhaps they could be prepared to testify on this. What I'm trying to get a sense of is, are you getting requests of the credit enhancement fund because, as I think you stated earlier, we have some really good companies that historically would have been bankable, just 100% the private sector, but now because of the condition of everything, they're seeking the backing of the credit enhancement fund. How much of that is a function of the health of that company versus how much of that is a function of the health of the bank?
You want me to answer that?
Go for it.
Okay. I think it's a combination of both, actually. You know, they're, you know, banks, by and large, have weathered the worst of the storm, at least what we've been able to, you know, see. And from our committee members who are part of the banking community, that's the general consensus, is that liquidity is returning at a reasonable level to the banking industry. However, the regulatory environment is not backing off. And so as a result, the rigor with which they can review their existing credits and then look at new credits is still pretty tough. And it comes down to exactly what you raised, in an earlier thing, was the collateral issue. Is that, and that's what this credit enhancement fund and the pledging of basically the state, you know, behind a portion of this loan enhances the collateral. And so therefore it makes certain deals doable where otherwise they wouldn't under the current regulatory environment. So we're very much looking at this as a bridge, you know, to be able to enhance the ability of the banking community to step in and serve their own customers and then potentially look out to new and enhanced customers. So a perfect, because we went through this in some detail in trying to figure out where there may be oversight in the committee level. And so, you know, there are, that where a lot of the compression has happened in credit within existing businesses that have suffered losses through this recession, is that when you come back in to renew, you know, you may have started with $1 million credit line, but based on where the bank has to go with ratios and everything else, you now have $500,000 credit line. And yet you have an order you're trying to fill, and you don't have the credit ability to go acquire the supplies and materials and go get it going. And so the whole idea of this is to be able to, you know, fill in that gap and allow the bank to be more comfortable, well, not more comfortable, be able to pass a regulatory review with regard to that credit with some backing from this side of the equation.
Thank you.
More?
Nope.
Yes. Cover it?
If we got it.
Okay. The one thing I would ask, you mentioned a number of things, or at least a few things in there, recommendations you would make. We are
searching for things that we can do to help the system out. If you could put those in writing to us, Lynn, or however you want to do that, it would be very helpful to us. Changes in programs, you mentioned Boost, for example. It would be helpful to know so I can share it with the other legislators, not just us on here, but the broader context, why it's a problem and what you think would make it easier for you to help Oregon grow.
Yep.
Thank
Chair
you very
Byer,
much.
Senators, thank you.
I'm going to ask Treasurer Wheeler up next. He has a time constraint. He has to be somewhere at 4:30. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Treasurer, it's all yours.
Thank you, Chair Byer. Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the treasurer for the state of Oregon. I'm very appreciative for the opportunity to be here today and outline what we are doing around economic development and business capitalization. I hope not only to outline some of the programs that we're currently engaged in, but also talk to you about some of the partnership opportunities with the state legislature going forward. In terms of the core subject area today, business financing needs, I've had the opportunity to travel around the state. I've talked to individual business owners. I've talked to bankers, chambers of commerce, business associations, community leaders, and others. And what we are hearing, by and large, is that there is an issue with regard to availability of business capital. As you learn from the folks at Business Oregon, and as you will hear from the representatives of the banking industry, the community banking industry that will be up following my testimony, it's too broad to make a blanket statement about business capitalization. There's different circumstances for different types of businesses, different sectors, different geographic regions. But the bottom line is this: whether you're talking to entrepreneurs at the early stage, small businesses that are currently established, larger business enterprises that would like to expand and hire Oregonians, there are gaps, significant gaps, that could be addressed through activities through the legislature, and I will talk about some of those opportunities. But first, I want to just review the current economic landscape as I was asked by the chair. In terms of business financing needs, the Treasury looks for opportunities all the time to deploy the assets we have for the betterment of Oregonians. And looking narrowly at the question of economic development, we have a number of tools at our disposal that are directly relevant. For example, over the last year, we've changed the banking collateralization rates, those rates that protect public sector deposits that are parked, if you will, with private sector lending institutions. We've lowered the collateralization rates as banks' own balance sheets become stronger, which freed up an additional nearly $1 billion that's available for those private sector lending institutions to lend to communities and Oregon businesses. But I want to caution, as we look at that capital that's available in this sluggish economy, the banks themselves then have to go through their own capital, their own analysis in terms of whether it makes economic sense for them to deploy those assets, given the volatility of the markets, the anemic returns that are currently available on loans, the risks that they would be taking, and in the current environment, their incentive to trade risk for returns is preciously low. So we've not only looked in our state in terms of the collateralization requirements, we've also approached the federal delegation to look at reforms that could be undertaken nationally around FDIC insurance requirements that could potentially free up billions of dollars nationally for business development. I also just want to be very clear that as I've gone around the state and spoken with businesses, they don't all see the current economic environment through the same lens. While I've heard repeatedly from business owners and operators that there is an issue with regard to access to capitalization. Not all businesses say that. Some businesses, for example, we've even had many startup companies report that while capital can be a problem, their primary concern and their first choice as far as deployment of resources would be around education and workforce development and higher education. Other businesses still report back to us that their preferential investment would be around deployment of resources towards infrastructural development. So I just want to caution, though my focus is on business capital, there's a whole spectrum of needs that help improve the ecosystem through which businesses are able to create jobs in the state of Oregon. Now, currently in the state of Oregon, we have been engaged in economic development activities, but really only in our very recent history. For the first 100 years of the existence of the Treasury, there were very few tools or opportunities for the Treasury to be directly involved in economic development activities. But the legislature, starting about 10 years ago, correctly started to see that the tools that we have in-house could, in fact, be substantial leveraging opportunities around job growth and economic development for our communities. For example, we were able to stretch both public and private infrastructural dollars through the School Bond Guarantee Act and the Measure 72 implementation, which made it more affordable for school districts to build infrastructure. And of course, through the Oregon Facilities Authority, we were able to help local nonprofits engage in construction projects, which not only created long-term opportunities for communities in terms of employment and serving the needs of communities, but of course in the short term obviously provided substantial construction jobs. I'll just note as a side note, in a couple of those cases that included the construction of large hospital and public health facilities, as well as university facilities, which are major employers in the state of Oregon. In terms of state-level assistance, this past year the Treasury restructured the lottery bond program, which freed up substantial lottery-based resources, which, as you all know, committee members, are for the specific purpose of investing in economic development purposes. And those are the funds that many of Business Oregon's programs that you just heard about are built upon. Finally, the Treasury has two direct investment pools that allow us to make direct investments in nascent Oregon businesses. These vehicles are called the Oregon Growth Account and the Oregon Investment Fund. And I'll just very briefly describe each of these two programs and what our current status is, if you will. The Oregon Growth Account is a fund focusing on in-state venture capital opportunities. It was created for the purpose of deploying resources in the state specifically. The OGA originally received 1.8% of lottery proceeds, but back in 2009, as a savings measure, that amount was halved for a period of 4 years. An important aspect of the Oregon Growth Account, the OGA, is it does not make direct investments in Oregon business enterprises. And this, I'll just put up a marker, this is a gap that we repeatedly hear about, that there's no tool whereby a business that shows promise for economic opportunities for the future, employment opportunities, can come to us and specifically ask for capital. Instead, what the Oregon Growth Account does is it works through funds, through both local and other venture capital funds, and supports businesses in that way. The reason we go through other agents is for two specific reasons. First of all, it's notoriously difficult to diversify a portfolio. If you're talking about a fairly limited geographic area, it makes sense to deploy resources through a manager who can help diversify, particularly if those funds have slightly different focuses, as the partners that we invest with do. Second of all, it also helps to leverage the state money, the Oregon Growth Account money, with outside resources. And we see leveraging outside resources as being one of our most significant opportunities. From 1995 to this past June, the Oregon Growth Account committed $104 million to general partners for investments. Through that period, $68 million was called for investments. The good news here is that amount was leveraged to more than $138 million. They've created a combined payroll of $42 million. 80 different Oregon-based employers participated. And a recent report to the Oregon Growth Account Board showed that Oregon-based jobs at those companies had nearly doubled from 432 to 860 after Oregon Growth Account investments in those companies. Another aspect of the Oregon Growth Account, which has been particularly highlighted in recent years, is the board's desire to make sure that there's economic activity at the early stage development of companies across the state of Oregon. Historically, venture capital has tended to be focused in the Portland metropolitan area, where larger companies are located, where there's more population. But in recent years, we've seen the value of investing in angel conferences around the state of Oregon. We're very proud of the fact that in this past year, we've had support for angel investor conferences. Two of the winners that we've supported were from Ashland this year, two are from Portland. One was from the Hood River area, and in October, I'll be attending a conference in the Bend area where we'll announce one or two more winners from the Bend area. So there is that commitment, but as you can tell, two here, one there, the commitment that's being made is really fairly small. It's important symbolically, and we're very glad that we're starting to see a commitment to geographic representation. But as far as a robust economic development strategy for the state of Oregon, it's not enough, in my opinion. To date, the OGA has returned $25 million to the Education Stability Fund. And I'm sure you all know that the OGA investments were supposed to go back into the Education Stability Fund, and that's what we're doing. We frequently get asked about the returns in the Oregon Growth Account. How are we doing on a return basis? And the answer is that since inception, the internal rate of return has been a negative 7.9%. I'm not making excuses, and I won't make excuses, but I will tell you that there's a cautionary note. I don't want to be unduly pessimistic about those numbers. Venture capital is the type of investment that relies on J-curve returns, meaning you make an early stage investment in a venture capital deal for a number of years. Those companies can have negative cash flows. They can lose money. They can have negative rates of return, and the presumption is that at some point those investment opportunities mature and you see a larger and larger return, and that's historically been called a J-curve return. That's typical of a venture capital portfolio. There's no guarantee that we'll see a J-curve return on the investments that have been made through the Oregon Growth Account, but that's the goal, and the returns we're seeing now are probably they're more or less consistent with what you would expect in this phase of the fund. OGA has been very successful, however, in another regard, putting rate of return aside for the moment. In terms of economic development bang for the buck, it's been quite positive. We've leveraged significant private sector investments into Oregon companies. We've leveraged significant out-of-state venture capital dollars into growing enterprises in the state of Oregon. I do believe that there's a way to refocus the Oregon Growth Account and make it even more of a leveraging impact in the state of Oregon, and I'll talk about those opportunities in a moment. In 2003, the Oregon Legislature passed an act, House Bill 3616, which created an entirely different fund, the Oregon Investment Fund. The legislature directed the Oregon Investment Council, which oversees the public pension plan, to develop a fund that would support early stage investment by using the assets in the public pension plan. To help achieve that, the Oregon Investment Council hired an outside agent, Credit Suisse, to set up and manage that process. At the end of 2010, OIF has invested $160 million in 23 different companies in Oregon, where they have attracted an additional $242 million in other private investments, and it's currently supporting over 1,200 jobs. Now, again, because of OIF's statutory requirement to limit itself to venture capital, we're looking at long-term rates of returns. The current returns on OIF are 2.73%. That's the IRR, the internal rates of return. A second round of investments is still being drawn down, so we don't have the actual rates of return on that yet. So, in sum, the tools that we do have at our disposal are relatively limited. They're statutorily focused on early stage investments, and it's my opinion that they could be better coordinated with other economic development tools, some of which you heard about here earlier. We're proposing, let me step back and give some context. This effort really was started by the governor, who during his transition into office started going around and he was meeting with people, business leaders, community leaders, and others who also identified to him the need for investment capital for businesses. So he asked the Treasury, along with other partners, including Tobias Reed and Business Development Commission Chair Bali Van Balkenberg, Tim McCabe from Business Oregon, Alan Alley, who was a founder of Pixelworks, Scott Nelson from the governor's office, and others, to look at what kind of strategies could potentially help grow Oregon businesses and how we could best utilize what economic development resources we have. We're in the process of coming up with what we're tentatively calling the Oregon Investment Act to answer the gaps that we identified in our studies. I'm going to give you a short preview of the key provisions of the Act, but I also want to put a caveat out there. This is still very much in its framework stage. There are many more facts that need to be uncovered. There's more research that needs to be conducted. There are more conversations we need to have across the state with stakeholders. And obviously, we're just beginning the process of engaging legislators. And we very, very much look forward to your partnership and your input. We don't see this as anybody's particular project. We think this is a good project for all of us to be working on right now, given our state's fiscal considerations. So what we're proposing is a consolidated fund that will potentially provide Oregon with a new economic development powerhouse for these kinds of investments. We're looking at the creation of a fund called the Oregon Growth Fund. It would be a completely new fund based on some of the principles that I'll outline in a minute. It would be managed by a completely new board called the Oregon Growth Fund Board. Before I jump into this, I want to be clear. We do not see this as creating new bureaucracies, and it has been our effort and will continue to be our effort that any time we create any time of an entity or a fund, we will consolidate or eliminate another one. So we don't see this as creating new bureaucracies. And from the perspective of businesses that need access to capital, we actually believe this will substantially streamline the process that currently exists. We're looking to create a fund that does a couple of things. Number one, it would significantly leverage out-of-state venture capital into the state of Oregon, much more than the Oregon Growth Account or the Oregon Investment Fund have been able to do. Number two, it will support the nation venture capital industry in the state of Oregon. On a positive note here, I want you to know Oregon has a very good and growing reputation around entrepreneurship, around innovation, around creativity, and Oregon entrepreneurs are starting to be rewarded for that success. We should build on that and help make that part of our economic development brand by better deploying our resources and supporting the growth of that industry. Third, on the early investment stage, particularly with entrepreneurial companies, we're seeing an interest and a desire on the part of businesses to have more managerial support, have an incentive to attract people to come to Oregon and stay in Oregon who are experts at growing companies through the various phases of development. Additionally, we're looking at strengthening the technology transfer, taking ideas from research to commercialization, and from commercialization to thriving ongoing business enterprises that can employ and support Oregonians and help to grow the per capita wages in this state. And last but not least, consistent with what you heard earlier from Business Oregon, we see an opportunity for this fund to work alongside the great programs that currently exist in Business Oregon by enhancing them and potentially expanding them into different areas to help existing business enterprises in the state of Oregon grow. In terms of a governance model for this, we're looking to a model that already exists in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Investment Council was created by you, the legislature, to oversee the public pension plan and a number of other investments. It provides independence. It provides accountability. It allows the board to smartly deploy all of its resources in a manner that's coordinated, consolidated, and under a strategic framework. It provides a mechanism to report back to the legislature and the public on the success, the relative success of how those assets have been deployed and what Oregonians have received in return. Given the current structure of economic development in Oregon, it makes sense because right now in Oregon, our economic development resources are fragmented. The legislature has a great deal of authority over economic development, but so too does the governor. So do other agencies, including the Treasury. And all too often, those resources aren't deployed under a strategic framework. There's no clear sense of prioritization in terms of what gets the best bang for the buck in terms of creating economic activity or jobs or wages for our citizens. There's no sense of geographic interest, and I think we have to include that given the highest unemployment rates in this state are in rural areas. And there's no mechanism whereby those various entities report back either to you or to the public in terms of how are we actually doing. Just to give you one quick example, does anybody know what the business capitalization gap is in the state of Oregon? Can anybody articulate that today? I'm not sure we actually can. And it seems to me that's a very important piece of information that we should know. If we could start consolidating this information and developing strategies and investing in priorities that help address true and identified gaps, it seems to me that would be a strength for the state of Oregon. So there's a couple of different ways that we would intend to pay for this. And I would not want to get out of this room without addressing this subject because I know you'll ask if I don't talk about it. There's a couple of ways we could do this that would not use taxpayer dollars. And I think in this environment, that's probably a good approach. Obviously, we have access to lottery bonds. The Treasury did restructure the lottery bonding process over the last year. The legislature did not use about $50 million of the lottery capacity in the last session that was available. That's one potential source. Going forward, we've identified about $282 million per biennium of resources that are potentially available. In addition, I would propose that the resources currently going into the Oregon growth account with this imperative on return could be redeployed with a focus not only on return, but also on economic development metrics, like leveraging out-of-state investment capital into Oregon, like payroll creation, like tax-based creation, like community support efforts. All of those things should be considered. So one potential source would be lottery funds. Another potential source that we're looking at derives from the very real interest that we've heard from people who say, hey, listen, I am a philanthropic person, or I am a corporation that has a vested interest in this state, or I'm an individual that would like to find a way to invest in the state of Oregon. What do you have that would allow us to invest in the state of Oregon? The answer is nothing specific today. I mean, there are different things that people could invest in, but there's no real investment vehicle. We propose creating one, and we're currently calling it the Oregon Growth Mutual Fund. It could be called anything you want, but the intention is to create a tax-advantaged fund whereby community-minded institutions or individuals or community foundations could invest their resources for the purpose of supporting this program. This is more than theoretical. We've already talked to two community foundations. One will allow me to use their name today, the Oregon Community Foundation. If we created this vehicle, they would set aside a sizable amount of their investment corpus for the purpose of investing in this fund to support Oregon economic development and growth. So that's the nuts and bolts of it. I will also just put a marker out there and say the governor has also asked our team, Tobias Reed, Alan Alley, Tim McCabe, et al., to look at other potential sources of funding that would create a fund even larger than what I've outlined and proposed here. So there's still lots of conversations going on about what else might be brought into the fold. In summary, I believe this would provide a very provocative statement for the state of Oregon. It would make it very clear that we care about business development and economic activity. It would help rural communities continue to support their growing economies, particularly in a time of high unemployment. This would help capitalize on our already developing brand around innovation and entrepreneurship, and it would coordinate and consolidate the fragmented economic development resources that we have many of that are currently deployed across different agencies and branches of state government. The best thing about this is wherever we go to talk about it, people say, how can we help? How can we participate in this? And I think it's one of the greatest things about living in this state is people want to have a means of participating in this program and living up to our traditional, our historic pioneering spirit. Oregon has really never had a moment where we've been very bold around economic development. We've tried different strategies, but we've never been very bold about economic development. I think that time has come. And I hope you'll work with us and be part of this partnership and help lead the partnership forward around the Oregon Investment Act. Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Mr. Treasurer, I actually have a series of questions. But before I get into the meat I want to talk about, you said leverage out-of-state venture capital. How do you do that?
There's a couple of different ways we can do that. One of the more interesting ways is through arm twisting, which is sort of a favorite. When you created the legislature, the Oregon Investment Fund, you gave the authority to the Treasury to figure out how to administer it. And the Treasury decided to do an RFP for an administrator and over somebody with expertise in venture capital investing, something the Treasury itself does not have. And we not only outsourced that effort beyond the Treasury, we actually insourced a company. Credit Suisse agreed to not only put their own dollars alongside our dollars in the fund, in other words, put skin in the game, they also agreed to have a physical presence and employ people in the state of Oregon to be part of that effort. So that's one way. When you're creating the fund, that's when you have tons of leverage in terms of structuring the fund. The other way is through the partners that you participate with. A lot of the partners that we participate with, particularly in the Oregon Investment Fund, aren't just based in Oregon. We have partners from Seattle, one from Alaska, a number from the Silicon Valley. If they see a good deal in the state of Oregon and they think it's good for their fund and their investors, they'll talk it up to their pool of investors, whether they're Oregonians or not. And so in that regard, we're able to leverage out-of-state dollars into the state of Oregon. Senator.
Thank you. I'm very skeptical of the need to go to Credit Suisse, I'll tell you. As somebody who does this professionally outside in my day job, I find Oregon to be miserable to raise money in. Just a horrible experience. And I don't know if that's because I serve in the legislature. It could be. But I'm beyond frustrated as a professional trying to raise money for the companies I do, and the fact that I do all my work out of state to get it done. In December 1st, 2009, the late Senator Westland put out an announcement that to the Oregon Growth Account was going to go a $5 million investment for what would be. In fact, I got the press release right here, into tech transfer, which you just mentioned as a goal, going into from the Oregon Growth Account into essentially, and I forgive me if I say it wrong, but Markham Hill Capital. How come that $5 million never happened?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, members of the committee. I first heard about this a couple of days ago, that this was a concern, so I took the liberty of doing a little research on it to refresh my memory and to go back and look at the press releases and talk to people who are actively involved in the process. The agreement that was struck, I believe it was in 2009 with Markham Hill, when they came before the Oregon Growth Account, was that they would raise $20 million to leverage the $5 million that OGA was willing to put in. The $5 million was contingent, as I understand it, upon Markham Hill raising their $20 million. They worked with the consultant to the OGA, they're called CTC Consulting. About a year went by, and they continued, Markham Hill, to work the investment chain and try to gain support for their fund. They sent word back to the Oregon Growth Account in, was it December of 2010, Mike? December of 2010, that they were not able to secure the leveraging dollars that they'd promised to the Oregon Growth Account and would not pursue it. So that's as far as I know.
Well, then let
now,
me,
now that said, Senator.
Hold on just a second. Let me read from the the press release. Markham Hill Capital is created, this is from 2009.
Yes, sir.
Is creating a venture capital fund that will connect private research efforts with world-class facilities at Oregon Health Science University. The venture fund is expected to help launch a wave of medical-related startup opportunities in the Portland area. They couldn't raise a measly, and I say measly because that's what it really is in the world of finance, $20 million in Oregon. The state said, nah, played games with the $5 million, and they couldn't raise $15 million from supposedly leveraging outside venture capital firms. Couldn't raise it in-state, couldn't raise it out-of-state. Why'd they fail?
Well, that I can't answer. I don't know why they failed. I've had two meetings with technology transfer people up at OHSU over the course of the last year. And though Markham Hill never specifically came up, their technology transfer efforts and their research funding efforts did come up. And the impression they left me, which was very much a positive impression, that they are in fact being very successful, particularly around cancer research and the potential commercialization of cancer drugs with Brian Drucker and the Knight Foundation contributing, I think it was $100 million, give or take $50 million, to that effort. So I can't speak to Markham Hill or why they were or weren't successful. I will tell you this. Technology transfer, particularly with research universities like OHSU, are one of our very best opportunities going forward. And we do support through the legislature and through our university system the signature research centers, Onami, Otradi, and others. So I can't really tell you what happened.
I don't want to ambush you, but I've been working for about 2 years in cancer research and funding cancer research companies. And they are going to leave Oregon. They're not going to locate in Oregon because they can't raise the capital. And I've talked to Oregon, who did you just say? I always forget their
Otradi.
Otradi. Very, very much is trying to get a fund started. They can't get a fund started. Right. They can't get money into the fund. They can't raise money in Portland. They can't raise money out of the growth account. They can't get money. So I think in Oregon what we do, especially in state government, is we drown ourselves in process all the time. And we have lots of processes and lots of task forces and lots of boards and lots of commissions. But at the end of the day, we don't raise lots of money, in my opinion. And so, you know, I've gone to every tool that I know inside of Oregon and come up with goose eggs. And other states, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, and the entire state of Ohio is very, and Iowa, is just eating our lunch. So we're, in my opinion, we are living up to what we are, which is a flyover state. Capital flies from Los Angeles to Seattle. And while we're having committee meetings here, so I mean, you can tell I'm frustrated. I'm actually not frustrated. I've passed frustration. I'm mad now, because this is my state, and I don't understand why the Oregon Growth Account doesn't get it. I just don't. I don't understand why the Oregon Growth Account doesn't get it.
May I help that?
Can you help me understand?
Yes. Yes.
Why we don't get it?
Yeah, I would. First of all, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on Markham Hill or anybody on the Oregon Growth Account, because I don't know the specifics of what was discussed in the 2009 meeting. I will say this. The leverage piece is important in terms of the deployment of our dollars. That's part of the purpose that was stated for the Oregon Growth Account when it was created by the legislature. Now, if Markham Hill, and this is theoretical and maybe they did this, I don't know. If Markham Hill went out and they could raise $10 million instead of $20 million and came back to the Oregon Growth Account and said, listen, here's the deal. We can only raise 10, not 20. Would we have talked to them? I sure would have. But they didn't come back. If they want to come back and have a different conversation with us, I'm certainly open to it. I do want to address what you just said, though, around the Oregon Growth Account and your frustrations. You may be shocked to learn I share your frustrations. It's too small. The Oregon Growth Account is basically tapped out. It was tapped out before the legislature cut our funding in half in 2009, in the middle of the worst recession in three generations. So that's part of the answer. But more to the point, you mentioned other states. You're spot on right, Senator. You know, the state of Ohio has deployed $1 billion over a 10-year period. The state of Michigan, $300 million. Utah, Virginia, Colorado, the state of Washington, California, they've all stepped up to the plate, not with $18 million loan participation funds or $1.2 million per quarter through the Oregon Growth Account. They're putting hundreds of millions of dollars into the bet on the future of their economies. So you could be the leader of this, because I think your frustration is not only palpable, I think it's spot on in terms of what the problem is in Oregon. We're thinking too small. We are focusing too much on committee structure and process. What we need to do is say, you know what, we give a darn enough about the future of this economy, and we have enough confidence in it that we're willing to put real dollars and real cents back it to the level that other states are doing. It shouldn't be that we have to fight for 6 months for $18 million for deployment of Business Oregon outreach activities, while in other states committing $750 million, Ohio, to the Third Frontier Program by going out to their public and getting support for it based on the success in generating jobs and economic development and keeping those companies in Oregon. So I agree with what you're saying.
Mr. Treasurer, I think I get your point. And
yeah,
I'm a little worried that I'm running out of time, and I've got a panel of bankers that I've asked to come. So I'm going to let you take that one offline with them. I'd like to hear back. Before I move, Senator Girard and then Senator Starr have questions.
I'll be very brief. TV now is filled with $500 million giveaways down in California for business that failed. You talk about a J curve, which to me is an initial loss, and I think it was 7%. Talk about high risk. I would just like to remind you of your fiduciary responsibility to this state and the fact that the flip side of this, if we go too far out, is our bond rating will go from will go south. And that happened at the federal level, and I just want to know what we're doing to protect our bond rating.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, protecting the state's bond rating has been one of my primary goals and the state treasury's primary goals for many, many years. And we enjoy a very strong credit rating. Despite the withering economic circumstances of the last few years, despite the fact that many states suffered credit rating downgrades, despite the fact that the federal government had troubles even agreeing when or how to meet on the subject of credit ratings and had their credit rating downgraded, the state of Oregon went up. Standard & Poor's had an increase from AA to AA+, which makes the cost of all of these infrastructure investments, schools, roads, bridges, research facilities, lower for Oregon taxpayers. Now, you've raised a good question. If we invest in all of these economic development things and deploy bonding capacity, does it hurt our credit rating or could it hurt our credit rating? The answer is yes, it most certainly could. That's why you have to be thoughtful about how you deploy it. You'll notice I didn't say increase taxes. What I proposed is using bonding capacity that still exists within the prudent limits on the lottery side that have already been signed off on by the credit rating agencies who gave us the AA plus, knowing that we'd already freed up $282 million in lottery capacity. So, and as far as the Oregon growth account, that's already in the mix. It's already there. The rates of return are what the rates of return are. So my professional opinion is it would not impact our credit rating.
Senator
but
Stark?
It's something we always need to be vigilant about, sir.
All I ask is that you provide us in writing the details of what you've shared with us today, because I haven't been able to write notes fast enough to get the entire picture. So I'm hopeful that you can provide us the details in a written form that we can review.
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, absolutely. Yes, sir.
Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate
your
dedication as well. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And committee, we've got one last panel, and I apologize if we've kept you waiting too long. Ms. Martinez, and I hope you got your son, was it, in school?
Yep.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Casey, good seeing you again.
You too, Senator.
Guy used to be my boss at one time.
He was a great employee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Do appreciate the opportunity to join you today and bring a couple of experts to talk about what's going on in business lending in Oregon. To my immediate right is Ken Troutman, who is President and CEO of People's Bank of Commerce, located in Medford, Oregon. He is also the Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon Bankers Association, and you may very well see him in 2013. As the chairman of the board of the association. Hopefully he won't mind coming up from Medford again. Next to Ken is, as you mentioned, Casey Hogan. Casey is the Executive Vice President and Chief Credit Officer from Pacific Continental Bank, which basically serves from Eugene all the way up the I-5 corridor through Portland. So I think they'll both be able to do hopefully a good job answering your questions about what's going on in the business lending arena. I would like to make a couple of comments before I turn it over to Ken. First of all, I want to thank the Business Oregon panel because I thought they raised some very good points about some of the problems that banks are seeing in the state when it comes to loans. And I would just take a quick stab at the regulatory piece. What I think banks are seeing in the state is kind of a one-size-fits-all regulatory scheme. And they look at banks in Oregon, and especially from the National Examiner's site, as if, you know, we're California or Florida or Nevada or some of these states that have had real difficult times. And they treat these banks as if they're located in those markets. I'll give you one quick anecdotal story. There's a bank in Southern Oregon who makes a lot of loans at the Running Y Resort on lots. They have at this point, I think, somewhere between 45 or 50 loans. All the loans are current. All of them have multiple sources of repayment. There may be one or two that potentially are at risk, but they're all good, solid loans that have been made over the years. At their last exam, the bank was told, we want you to classify all these loans, which means you have to put them in a different pot, and the regulators look at those as potentially troubled loans. The management team down there said, look, these are all current. We showed you that. We've demonstrated that they have multiple sources of repayment. Why do we need to do that? And they were told, well, again, we've seen problems with home sites on golf courses in Florida and Nevada and California, and we want to be safe. Well, I think we would all agree that Klamath Falls, Oregon is not quite Las Vegas or any place in Florida. So it was very frustrating, and basically what it's meant in that market is they're not making any more loans out there. So think how that, you know, trickles down through the economy. Nobody's going to be building houses on home sites that aren't sold, and it becomes very difficult to do that. And you know, hopefully at some point they will start making loans again on those properties. If I could, I'd like one more minute before I turn to Ken, and just to kind of let the committee know, NFIB for years has put out a monthly kind of what a small business think, what's going on in their minds. Their latest in August basically said that the small business confidence level took a huge hit in August. It was a decline for 6 months running. It was down to 88.1%, which was down 1.8%, and that the big factors that the small business folks saw was a small expectation for any kind of real sales growth, and that business conditions were their major problem. Specifically on credit, which is what you're here to talk about today, they said this: 4% reported financing as their number one business problem. 4%. So for the overwhelming majority, credit supply is not a problem. 93% reported that all their credit needs were met or that they were not interested in borrowing. 7% obviously then reported that not all of their credit needs were satisfied. By the way, the record low on that is 4%. And 50% said they did not want a loan. 25% of the owners reported that weak sales continue to be their top business problem, so new investments in new equipment or new workers are not likely to pay off by generating enough initial earnings to repay the loan required to finance the investment. 4% of owners reported higher interest rates on their most recent loan, while 3% reported getting a lower rate. 32% of all owners reported borrowing on a regular basis, up 2 points and only 4 points above the record low. And then lastly, a net 13% reported loans harder to get, unquantified, but harder to get compared to their last attempt, and that was up 3 points. So with that, I would turn it over to Ken and Casey, and would encourage the committee, if they have questions, these gentlemen are the ones that can probably answer them for you.
Chairman Beyer and committee, thank you on behalf of Oregon Banking Association for inviting us here. The Oregon Banking Association has been a voice of Oregon banking industry for 105 years. We represent state and national commercial and savings banks doing business in Oregon. These are Oregon's FDIC-insured depository institutions that are highly regulatable state and federal level. In all of our association endeavors, we strive to ensure that Oregon remains a good place to do business and a good place to conduct the business of banking. The success of our businesses, including our banks, is essential to the overall health of the Oregon economy. OBA serves as a voice of banks, large and small, throughout the state of Oregon. Let me describe People's Bank a little bit. Senator Atchison is familiar with our group. We are we have our state chartered bank that organized 14 years ago. I was one of the co-founders of the bank, located in Medford with branches in Ashland and Central Point, currently building our fourth branch location, or getting ready to start our fourth branch location in Medford. Again, we're a small bank. We have about $116 million in total assets. About 78% of those are out in commercial loans. Our activity over the last few years doesn't necessarily mirror the industry. We're currently experiencing about a 16% growth in loans. All of those are in the Southern Oregon area. Our trade area runs from the Southern Oregon coast, the Brookings area, through Klamath Falls, Roseburg, Grants Pass, and the Medford-Ashland area. The constraints that we've seen in banking right now are many, both at the local and at the federal level. We've had some discussion recently on the regulation and the changes. To give you an example of what we go through, and we're a very simple bank. We make commercial loans. We have a very small consumer loan portfolio. We do residential real estate lending, and we raise deposits, and that is all we do. If you go back a few years, a capital level to be considered highly capitalized at our level is 5%. Currently, the capital that still is the criteria that the regulators use, but they've raised the threshold down to 10%. Now, what that means to our bank, we've got about 11%, 11.5% capital. They basically took $100 million away from us in potential growth. just by limiting capital availability. Not only that, the liquidity requirements that we're now required to hold have been doubled also. And that in itself, when you look at business banking throughout the nation, has been a limitation on what banks can do with lending. There is a tremendous challenge, at least in Oregon, and I think it probably covers pretty much the 12th district, which would include Washington and California, Arizona, Nevada. Our challenge really is getting qualified borrowers. Now, I mentioned we have about a 16% growth. The reality to get that growth, we're declining 70 to 80% of the applicants come in. And we're declining those clients, not because they don't have experience, not that there may not be a market, it's their financial statements don't support the loans. Whether I think they can pay me back or not is immaterial. It's what I can document and support. If I'm, as a bank, were to take a risk on those borrowers, this first examination I have from regulators, that loan's going to be classified. It's going to be added to those other classified loans. The next step would be a memorandum of understanding with the regulators on how I'm going to clean up the credit mess I've created or how I'm going to raise capital to support it. So banks are not in the position of taking risk. Now, what we've been able to do, and I think we heard earlier from Business Oregon, that one of the challenges is banks have got borrowers on their books that they're trying to work with. Unique scenario for us, we're a very active SBA lender, government lender. Over 15% of our loans are either SBA guaranteed using Business Oregon or any other, USDA, Southern Oregon or Economic Development out in Southern Oregon. It's a very active piece of what we do. Interestingly, what we've been able to do in our market, we have three regional banks that have been extremely troubled. Those clients that they have that were looking for credit had very few alternatives. They were unable to go through their own banks and do a restructure because their financial statements did support it. Those clients who have, in some cases, a 20 or 30 year history, were able to come into our bank. We could look at their financials, see the trend they had, and using a government guarantee, SBA primarily, restructure their credit, their loan portfolio. Now, you can't do that when that credit's yours. So if I have the loan to start with and I'm trying to restructure and work with a client, I can't do that. The thought being that all I'm doing is shifting the risk from my credit portfolio to the government. But as another bank who's working with that client, I have the ability to restructure and assist a borrower. A good example, we had a 40-year-old business, I think it was the third generation, that had been working with a regional bank, trying to get a restructure to get their cash flow down to where their actual income would support it. We're able to do that. We sat down and we could document an improvement in their financials. And the improvement that they were showing is pretty similar to all businesses in our market, and I'm assuming it's the same in Eugene. 3 years ago, most businesses had a terrible year, lost money. Made very few adjustments to their business plan because they weren't sure if it was a temporary scenario, and most of the adjustments they had to make were employee-driven. Very reluctant to let employees go. 2 years ago, business is still down, but now they had to make those hard calls, and they reduced their staff, and that's why we're seeing an unemployment rate in Southern Oregon that's about 11.7% currently. Now, if you go back and look at those same businesses, they are actually at break-even, maybe showing a small profit. But they've learned to do it with more efficiency. They've made a sizable reduction in their employment and their employees, but they now are viable businesses. But for me to look at that business and do a lending on it, I'm going to document 2 years of losses, which is not a bankable credit. But if you're using one of the government programs, whether it's Business Oregon or USDA or SBA, you can now bridge that gap and do a projection. We know they have management potential and experience. We know they've managed through hard times in the past, but they're going through one of the most difficult cycles we've ever lived in. And so we bridge some of those clients' loans. Collateral, I know, was a discussion earlier with one of the panels. If you're doing an SBA loan, it says right in their manual of procedure that collateral would not be the only reason that you decline a loan. Unfortunately, the regulators don't look at it that way. They're strongly looking at what the underlying collateral is. From a bank our size, it's very easy for us to look at our portfolio. If we have loans out that are collateral dependent, first thing we're doing is marking those to market. If it's real estate related, what is the market for a real estate loan? Very, very difficult. If you get an appraisal and it documents a reduced value of your loan, first thing you do is you write your loan down to that balance and take a loss on your financial statement. And that was the reality of banking in the 09 period. I think we all took most of those big hits. Severe hit to capital for most banks. We were very fortunate in that we had a lot of capital to start with, which is what it took to get through this market. We're aggressively looking for loans in our market. As Senator Atkins can attest, I flood the airways with radio messages talking to the community to come in. A lot of what I do, frankly, is community service. Clients of other banks will come in. I'm a slow-moving target. I'm headquartered in Medford. If they want to talk to me, they don't pick up the phone and call. They show up at my desk. And most of what I'm doing is counseling. And a lot of times it's telling them the requests from the banks that they have, that they're currently at, are reasonable. You need to work with them. The banks are under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure from their own regulators. What they're asking you to do is not unreasonable. In other cases, I tell them it's an issue of the bank, not an issue of the borrower. And that's the kind of client that I can then work with. So we're out there looking. Unfortunately, a lot of my activity and my growth, even though we're very proud of 16% growth, isn't new business. Most of that's existing businesses restructuring and trying to improve their cash flow. We are seeing some new activity in Southern Oregon. We have to document, probably more so now than ever, cash flow, secondary sources of repayment, collateral coverage, business experience. We're not in the business of taking risk. We've talked and we've heard a little bit earlier about venture capital. It scares me to death when we talk about that, especially if we're using government money. When we first started our bank, we used SBA loans to assist startup businesses. We found out pretty quick we were not smart enough to determine whether those businesses could survive. And our loss ratio, even with a 75% guarantee, exceeded what we could handle as a small community bank, and we had to back out. We recognize that projections are just that, projections, and they're very, very difficult. What I can do well with is a proven history, an existing company. I can analyze their financials. I can look for weaknesses. I can kind of project where they might be because I know what they can do. So I would caution you as we start looking at public money on the venture capital side. You know, you want to be paid back, and those sometimes can be very, very, very difficult loans to do. Our local economy down in Southern Oregon, probably one of the third hardest hit, probably in the state of Oregon, maybe second behind Bend. Unemployment, frankly, in our area is understated. And the concern I've always had when we look at unemployment, especially in communities like ours where we have a large self-employed population, those self-employed people are not counted in the unemployment. In theory, they call and do a reference check or to find out what the numbers are, but of the clients I deal with, most are self-employed. None have ever had a call from the employment division to find out what their employment numbers are. But the predominant amount of the activity we do was construction development in Southern Oregon. We were fortunate to kind of take a shift before the market changed in 05. Right now, we're back into construction lending. There is a market out there. There are clients that want to build. It is not as great as it was, and it shouldn't be as great as it was. There's a big inventory of residential houses. Our home prices on the bottom end have stabilized, and that's critical for our area, probably critical for the state. The median price and the upper end are in flux, and quite a bit of inventory to deal with in that area. And businesses are surviving. They're not growing. And for our local economy to take off, we need those businesses to have some faith in the future, faith in the tax brackets and what's going on at the federal level, and a comfort that things aren't going to change. They just need some consistency. The banks need some consistency in regulation. We don't need another level on top. Dodd-Frank is coming out with a whole round of 200 or 300 new rules that we've got to live with that none of us have seen. I've got a staff of 42. I'll probably need at least one full-time person just to administer the regulations. It's not going to be a productive. One last comment. I need to be right 99% of the time when I'm in the lending business. We live on a 1% margin. I mean, we should make 1% on our assets to be considered successful in today's market, which is not much. If I make a 1%, if I'm right 98% of the time, my bank is not performing. That's the level that we have to operate at. It's a very, very tough market out there. Banks want to loan. We're sure looking at every opportunity. We currently have approved a loan in Ashland for about $5 million. It's going to create 15 new jobs. We bid against 4 other banks on that loan. If it's a $100,000 loan and a quality borrower, we're bidding against 2 or 3 other banks. So there's a lot of activity chasing that quality borrower. There's just a lot of borrowers that aren't qualified in today's market.
One question I had, I just want clarification. You said that you mentioned two pieces of changes in regulation, your asset value, I think it was, and liquidity. Are those federal rules, state rules, or both?
Well, we're a state chartered bank, right, but we're insured by FDIC. And so our primary regulator is the FDIC Insurance Corporation.
And are these changes in the way they're administering their rules, or are these actual changes in rules?
Chairman Beyer, committee, the reality of the rule right now is there is a fear at the regulator level that they're going to make mistakes that will impact their jobs, and they have tightened up every level of underwriting we do. We just mentioned two areas, talking about liquidity and talking about capital. Concentrations are another one. You know, we've got regulations that actually are considered guidelines, but frankly are hard and fast rules that say I won't loan over 100% of my capital out in construction and development. And it's ADC, acquisition, which is land loans, development, and construction. That's a hard and fast rule written as a guideline. The second one is I won't loan over 300% of my capital out to commercial real estate, which includes investment property. Those are finished buildings, and a lot of those creating jobs. Hard and fast rule. I think most banks in Oregon probably exceed that number right now, or are very close to it. So those limitations all of a sudden put a constraint on lending. We watch those numbers extremely close in our bank. We're currently under every one of those, but there's a limit where I all of a sudden run into an area where I can't lend. We're getting very close right now.
Mr. Hogan.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity of being here. It's fun to watch the process work its way through. So, again, thank you. I also want to thank LBA for the opportunity of joining the panel. Tim does a great job in helping us, and enjoyed Ken's comments, and I would echo almost every point that he made as you know, same thoughts that we would have. If I could, I'd like to take just a couple of minutes and maybe highlight a little bit about my bank, as Ken did. I think it gives you kind of a representative sample of kind of the community banks in Oregon, because I think each one of us would have similar stories. Most of the points I would agree, some of them I have a little bit different take on. I'd like to touch on a little factual information about our company that may be, it's mostly a public information because we are a public company, so I have to kind of stick with what we publish, but then also address a couple of issues. So first of all, Pacific Continental Bank, we're a public traded company headquartered out of Eugene. We've been there since 1972. As Tim mentioned earlier, we have offices, 14 of them, that are located up the I-5 corridor as far north as Seattle and running down to Eugene. Approximately 10 or 11 of our offices are in Oregon, so we have a very focused footprint in the state of Oregon. We have about 280 employees, of which 250 are in the state. So we have a very keen interest in what happens in our state here. As a bank, as many of the community banks are, we have a focus that's fairly closely defined as community-based businesses, meaning those mom-and-pop, those Main Street businesses in our communities that we can sit down and talk with the owners and, you know, the primary stakeholders on making decisions. We also focus on not-for-profit and nonprofit organizations where we've been active a very long time. And then also the medical professional world, primarily, specifically in the dental world. We have a very strong interest and kind of an expertise in that area, too. So we try not to be everything to everybody. Might be a little bit different than some of the community banks who are in communities where they have to be everything. We tend to be in the larger communities so that we can stay focused within those niches, get very good at what we do, and be a resource. Some of the panel talked earlier about being consultative, and that's really where we add value as being a community, you know, a treasure, if you will, where we've got that depth of expertise that we're willing to provide in the most instances for free, as Ken mentioned earlier, where you're talking to these borrowers, these customers, helping to provide some advice and counsel where they may be able to take their business. Like Ken, we've been a strong participant in the SBA programs. We're a nationally preferred lender, so we have some advantages that way as far as being able to streamline that process. We're an active participant with some of the state, the Business Oregon programs, specifically the Capital Access Program we've used quite extensively. In fact, as I go back and I look at some of our numbers, about 10% of the loans, roughly 8 to 10% that we do, does have some sort of a state program participation to our small business loans, and this is, you know, defined by compliance purposes, as well as about 10% have some sort of an SBA support as well. We generally use those programs, again, for credit enhancements where we've identified a weakness that otherwise would give us some discomfort in doing it. Maybe it's an extending the terms of the loan so that the cash flow is improved. Maybe it's a collateral position, as we mentioned earlier, where there's a little bit of shortfall. Maybe it's a startup, as Ken mentioned earlier, for what few startups that we would actually participate where we can buy into the projections, we might use an SBA guarantee as an example to help enhance that credit. So again, like many of the community banks in the state, we are very active with those programs and feel like that they do a good job. Business Oregon has been very active out in the communities, talking to us about their programs, very responsive. I have no complaints about the products and services that they offer. So as Ken mentioned earlier, we are under, you know, some regulatory issues today. I'm not here to speak about that other than to indicate that there is some uncertainty out there. As an example, our bank, from a liquidity standpoint, we have a lot of capital to lend. So we're actively out there looking for it. As an example, from a regulatory standpoint, Chairman Beyer, you ask, 10% is considered, 10% capital is considered to be a well-capitalized bank. Our bank currently sits at over 18% in capital. So it's a ratio that's higher than what we know we would need from a regulatory environment. In fact, from the standpoint of how much does that give us in excess of capital today, that's about $92 million if you look at our balance sheet. When you lever that up 10 times or so, that's a significant amount of loans that we could put out in the market, which we would like to do, at least maybe not all of that, but we'd like to put a good chunk of that out to work. We also see opportunities with the consolidation of the industry. That's the reason we have the capital there, is to help our industry consolidate as appropriate as we work through this process. So I think all of our banks, for the most part, are fairly well capitalized and are prone for taking advantage of the growth opportunities that are out there. So I guess that, and again, it points to the fact that for the most part, our community banks in the state of Oregon have the resources, have the capital, would love to put it out there because, frankly, we could earn a little bit more money than we would sitting in Fed funds and other alternative investments that are not very good right now.
Anything else.
Exactly. As far as regulatory, the other thing that's uncertain, and Ken touched on it, is we just frankly don't know how much the regulators will require. Again, 10% is today what's expected to be well capitalized. We believe that under Dodd-Frank that changes, or at least by interpretation or by guidance that changes. We just don't know what it is. So is 12 the new 10? Is 14 for some okay? So there's some uncertainty out there as to just how much capital a bank does need to have, how much liquidity, you know, how much you need to have in liquidity that's available for coverage. There's some uncertainty there. And that's frankly one of the areas from the regulatory standpoint that causes us some heartburn, is really trying to figure out where we're going from the regulatory agencies. Commercial real estate continues to be kind of the driver in the economics of our banks. As Ken mentioned, most of us have bumped up against. We were above, as he mentioned, those guidelines. We're now down below, more so from a you've got to get there, but also the market kind of took us there too, as the opportunities pushed us away from, you know, continuing to lend in the commercial real estate area and the construction. So I think that's kind of settled out to some extent. We, like Ken, are doing some construction, but mostly it's on pre-sold type of activities where you've got good investors, good owners with plenty of equity. The if you look at the liquidity in the banks today, again, I referenced that earlier, a lot of that is because of the reduction we've seen in the commercial real estate lending activity. That was the driving force for a lot of the community banks in the state. The demand from the commercial and industrial, we call them the C&I, hasn't replaced that kind of the runoff of liquidity from the commercial real estate. So there is a lot of liquidity and capital, as I mentioned earlier, ready to go to work. The as I look at our own bank, and I think it would probably be consistent, Ken is maybe in a little bit different situation, as he mentioned, but what I look at, how many business loans have we done over the last 3 years, and has that number had a strong ebb and flow? We've been very consistent. And in our bank, we would report regulatorily, we make about 550 small business loans a year. And again, as I mentioned, about 10% of those run with some sort of state support. Some SBA has some participation in there. Generally, we run about 10% decline, a little bit lower than what Ken would report. But again, you know, part of that is I think we all work very hard at trying to find ways to make loans happen. Our commercial lending officers, our team leaders, our market presidents, they are expected to grow loans. They're expected to grow their markets. They're expected to do that profitably. Our bank is expected from our shareholders, investors, to continue to grow and be profitable. We do that by making loans. We don't do that by putting money in the market at you know, subprime rates today. The Ben mentioned earlier, you know, is the bank's role that of being a venture capitalist? Certainly we don't think so. As Ken said, we have about a 1% error margin, and for the most part we do pretty good staying under that. Some of us missed that a couple years ago, and we don't want to do that again, and neither do our regulators. So from a venture capital standpoint, we've got to leave that to the other folks who have the stomach for it, that can ride that J curve, as Secretary Wheeler talked about earlier. I think there is a role for us to continue to be involved, and we all continue to look for those opportunities, and again through the enhancement opportunities from some of the programs that are out there, as well as our own appetite where you've got good solid credit requests that are coming in. Some of the issues that I see is the kind of the applications that we're seeing that we're not able to do. Again, most of them we find a way. Our lenders do a very good job, and I think that'd be consistent throughout the banking community. We do a pretty good job at trying to find a way to say yes, trying to find those opportunities. The ones we struggle with the most, as I talk with my lenders in preparation for testimony today, is the ones where they have no capital. They have no investment of their own to come in. They have no experience in running that type of a business. Really what they're looking for is trying to buy themselves a job through getting a loan, buying a franchise, opening a restaurant, starting a repair shop, those types of things that they may have a skill set for the technical side of it, but they don't have the capital, they don't have the experience for managing a company. They have great hearts and good plans, but it just, there's some things that are lacking there. So those are the ones that we struggle with the most today. I would tell you that it's kind of a mixed bag what demand is. You know, you hear different stories. I would tell you that I think demand is reasonably stable, but there's an awful lot of competition for each opportunity that comes through our doors. It's good. I think Ken spoke to that earlier, that we're seeing the same things. If you get a really good opportunity, there's a lot of people at the door, sometimes willing to sacrifice structure, pricing, and rate, and controls in order to get the deal, which is a concern to me as a banker if we start down that path again of giving away too much and not practicing prudent banking underwriting. The I guess in closing, a couple of things. You know, I see this, I guess, jobless recovery, if that's what we're in. And you know, I've been in banking for 34 years, 16 of which here in the state of Oregon, been through a couple of cycles, but this one's been the longest and, you know, certainly the most difficult. I think we're probably in some sort of a jobless recovery, but frankly, that's the bottom line, is we need jobs. We need these people out there spending their money, helping to support our businesses, creating that environment for the bankers to, you know, have confidence that the cash flows that are being projected are going to be sustained and available to us going forward. And I think finally, if I could, Chair Beyer, I'll end with a quote recently made by our Chief Executive Officer, Hal Brown, I wasn't able to be here today, but I thought this quote was pretty good in an article that we send out to our employees as well as our investors as well as our customers. And it kind of sums up my thoughts today is, contrary to what you may infer from media reports, community banks are willing and deeply interested in lending money. After all, it's what our charter is all about, and it's why we chose banking careers, and it's how banks make a profit. In the case of Pacific Continental, we are making loans. Just not as many or as often as we did prior to the recession. So with that, Chair Beyer and committee members, thank you for your time. And I'm certainly happy to, as Ken is, I'm sure, to answer questions or address comments you might have.
What I think I heard from you both is that regulations are a bit of a problem. It's the uncertainty more than, perhaps even more than regulation itself. It sounds like most of that's coming out of the FDIC and the unknown from the new Dodd-Frank Act, that's more of a problem than even the state, although I suspect you see some inconsistency as state-chartered banks from between our regulators, state regulators, and the feds, or maybe not.
Well, Chair Beyer.
It's always, you may not want to answer that. I understand. They may be in your bank right now.
Chair Beyer and committee members, if I could take a stab at it, I'll probably walk around most of that. But I think we recognize as a bank, as bankers, and as a banking industry, that our regulators have a very tough job. They certainly were not expecting to get, that we would be where we're at today. So I think they're certainly doing everything they can be to protect the deposits that are under their insurance, to help us as banks weather their way through this, to make the right decisions, both with where we're at today as well as help set the stage for where we should go in the future. So, I really don't have concerns with how we're being regulated today, per se. Your point, though, is there is a high degree of uncertainty. Again, with the 2,700 pages in Dodd-Frank, with at least 200 and some odd regulations or rules that will be coming at us, we've only seen a handful of those so far hit us, and it's been significant for us to adjust to them. And then, frankly, it causes us pause to really wonder why we're in certain lines of businesses that will be, so you've got to look at those regulations, apply them to your business model, say, do they still fit? Is it worth the regulatory risk for us to stay involved with this line of business? Or are we better off redeploying assets, taking our personnel another direction and doing something that we know that we can do? So that's kind of the realities of what we're looking at. I don't know if I touched on it, but it looks like Tim would like to add something, too.
I just wanted to add Tim Martinez again. I just wanted to add a statistic that I recently read, and it applies primarily to community banks, but also to the larger institutions as well. Most community banks now have 1.1 compliance officer to every loan officer. That you can't make money if you've got more people making sure you're following the rules than you are lending, and that's a problem.
And Chair Beyer and committee members, if I could too, just anecdotally, I was with my human resource officer yesterday, and we were trying to look through our departments. How many people have we added just to comply with new regulations, not just the FDIC, but the others? And you just keep ticking them off. In my credit administration department example, I've probably added at least 3, if not 3.5 people. That's out of a staff the size of maybe 20. So I've added that many more just to be in compliance or to do things that help us stay out of trouble with regulators.
It's the other side of job development.
Exactly. We're not making any more money necessarily, but, we're certainly reporting a lot more.
One other question that I had is, one of the ones I threw out was, it's a relationship with state loan programs and the question of availability through the state programs. Would it make more sense for the state to focus more on participation loans versus guarantee versus the direct loans? And I'm kind of gathering from all the discussion today that the guarantee is probably more beneficial to you, meeting your regulators' demands.
Chair Beyer and the committee, I agree with you. We in this market where there's so much uncertainty with borrowers' financial statements, the guarantee side has been a critical element. And the real benefit, frankly, I know we're seeing at our bank and I'm sure it's yours, if you have a guarantee on a loan, the regulators aren't really looking at that loan. So they're focusing on other loans but those. So in essence, you get a past credit that we now don't have to worry about and can put aside. Now, we monitor every credit all the way through. I mean, again, we can't afford to lose even a 5 or 10 or 20% piece of a loan because of mismanagement on the credit side. But there's a tremendous assistance to the banks. For us, to give you an example, the last quarter of last year, SBA came out with two major changes that assist us. One was they raised the loan limit from roughly $2 million to $5 million. They waived the fee for the guarantee and kind of streamlined the process for the applications. We did more in one quarter than we did the whole year. Tremendous benefit for our clients. And an example of cost, if you were looking at a $4 or $5 million loan, that waive of the fee might be $150,000 to $175,000 that client now has to use to run their business as working capital or do employment. If I can make one comment on a concern I have, and it doesn't affect you, and I've got to figure out how to deal with it. I'm still shocked in our local community, and I hope it doesn't happen everywhere, that our local agencies that approve construction, development, and growth have not gotten on board how to work with clients. You have a borrower who wants to build a business, and what they run into is roadblocks on what they can't do, not on what they can do. And if the message we can get from you or from the governor or whoever, maybe our local communities, is to get those folks on board with, these are good businesses. Personally, our own business and our expansion of our bank, we have a site that the local municipality tried to take our access away. How do you promote business if you can't get into the business? These are strange things. I hear that with every one of my clients. And I don't know if that's unique in our community or not, but if we're trying to get these guys off track, let's figure out how to streamline that process when they already have the financing, they've got the money to invest, and we're not really working with them to make them get them fast-tracked to the process.
Well, I don't know if it was on a state highway or not, but that's an issue. The access, they're called access management, is something we understand. We took some action on that bill this last session. And we're focusing on that, trying to deal with some of those, doing what we can. We've pretty much run out of time unless somebody else has questions. I thank you very much for making the trip to Salem today. I know that takes you away from an office. It may be good or bad, I don't know. But I know, particularly, Ken, you had a long way to come up here, so we really appreciate it. Tim, I will look to you. You and I have talked in the past about suggestions that the OBA has talked about that might be helpful, that the legislature could do to deal to help make capital more accessible. If there's something you could share with us, not today, but in writing, some suggestions for legislation, we would be more than happy to look at those and anything we can do to help. Our job, quite frankly, as I said at the start, and I can't remember if you're here, is what I'm interested in. I think what this committee is interested in is getting the state positioned to move forward when the economy turns, particularly, and anything in between, you know.
So thank you for your good work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Most appreciated. Anything else for the good of the order, members? If not, am I missing anything, Patrick?
See you in November.
You're adjourned.